from the high desert in the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you may be in all 24 time zones covered by this program, which is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell, glad to be here. In a moment, we're going to have a guest from a town even smaller than the little town of Pahrump that I live in, a place called Searchlight, Nevada. And he is none other than Assistant Democratic Leader in the Senate. He's Senator Harry Reid. Coming right up. Stay right where you are. For comparable products. Plus, with your order, you'll receive a free book on HGH, a $20 value, absolutely free. So, call my good friends at Great American Products and order Ultimate HGH today at 1-800-557-4627. That's 1-800-557-4627. 1-800-557-4627.
Mo, ever leave home and feel like you forgot to turn everything off?
Well, now that you mention it, maybe.
Remembering to take care of everything is an important part of any road trip.
Did I leave the oven on?
Pep Boys can help make sure your car's ready.
Hey, do you guys smell smoke?
Pep Boys Inspection and Maintenance Services will help make sure a car's good to go. Belts, hoses, tires, oil, AC, even a free brake inspection.
A trip to Pep Boys should be on everyone's to-do list before they leave on their summer vacation.
Guys, I gotta run.
Pep Boys, we're car people.
Now, Senator Harry Reid actually does come from a smaller town than I do, Searchlight, Nevada. From humble beginnings in the tiny town of Searchlight to the second highest ranking Democrat in the U.S. Senate, Harry Reid has distinguished himself as a fighter for Nevadans and all American families in the corridors of power in Washington, D.C., recognizing his trajectory in public service. The Las Vegas Sun said that Reid, quote, has gone from underdog to the Senate's top dog, end quote. Parade Magazine, the nation's largest weekly, identified Senator Reid as one of a handful of leaders in Washington who possesses, quote, integrity and guts, end quote. A Nevadans first elected him to the Senate in 1986, and he has developed a reputation as a consensus builder and a very, very accomplished legislator. He is my senator in Washington. And here's something, just a partial statement. I won't read it all because really he can tell you about it, but this was a statement by Senator Reid Friday, February 15th. Quote, today President Bush has betrayed our trust and endangered the American public by deciding to ship 77,000 tons of nuclear waste across the entire country and store it at Yucca Mountain, Nevada. As a candidate for president, George W. Bush declared, quote, I believe sound science, not politics must prevail in Washington, must prevail in the designation of any high-level nuclear waste repository, and Washington as well. As president, I would not sign legislation that would send nuclear waste to any proposed site unless it's been deemed scientifically safe, end quote. He said this while campaigning in Nevada in May of 2000. You know, he was here in Nevada, said that. Didn't ask us to read his lips, but asked us to believe him. Nevadans did. George W. Bush would not be president without having received Nevada's votes in the Electoral College. You remember that debacle of an election that we had? Well, without Nevada, it would not have been President Bush, and without that promise, I doubt that he would have had Nevada here. From, I'm not sure exactly where, maybe at home in Searchlight is Senator Harry Reid. Senator?
Yes, I am in Searchlight. I have a home there, here, I should say, and that's where I am.
At home, all right. Well, as you well know, your little town is actually smaller than mine in Trump.
Yes, a lot smaller.
Senator, take it from there. I mean, I didn't read your entire statement, but I've got a million questions. I mean, how angry are you about what has happened here?
Well, I just feel that if we go back and look at the election, George Bush came to Nevada once. He came to Lake Tahoe. He wouldn't take questions from the press because at that time he was afraid to answer any questions regarding nuclear waste because his position had always been contrary to Nevada's interests. But as the election got closer and closer and he felt Nevada's four electoral votes may mean something, and at that time Gore was ahead in the election, he issued a number of statements through other people, through the Vice President Cheney, through Governor Gwynn and others, saying that he would not allow nuclear waste to come to Nevada except if there were good science. And
all right, well, that's the obvious next question. How is the science on this? What do you know?
Well, from the time that he made that statement till today, the science has been turned on its head. For example, the General Accounting Office, which is the watchdog of Congress, certainly no one can ever accuse them of being anything but unbiased. They said that it was not ready to have a recommendation made because, as we speak, there's 292 scientific investigations that the DOE is waiting for. In addition to that, the Nuclear Waste Technical Review Board, which is an entity set up to review nuclear waste, again, independent. This one is led by former dean of the Yale School of Forestry. He's now president of Carnegie Mellon in Pennsylvania, one of the finest schools in America. He through and his group said the science at Yucca Mountain is poor. We know that there's a big law firm that was giving legal advice to the Department of Energy, and their own inspector general found there was a conflict of interest because that law firm was also representing the Nuclear Energy Institute at the same time it was giving advice to the Department of Energy.
Oh, great.
So President Bush simply should not have done this. We learned in Time magazine that came out today that we're trying to get rid of soft money, you know, corporate money.
Mm-hmm.
And so Time magazine has gone into a review as to what money President Bush took in soft money, and $25,000 we know that he took from the Nuclear Energy Institute, the same group of people that's trying to put nuclear waste in Nevada. So he had plenty of information not to do what he did, just withhold what he was doing until he had some evidence to show there was sound science. He didn't wait to do that. I think it was unfair. I think he misled the American, not only the people of Nevada, but the American people. I'll stop by just saying this. The number one issue in America today with every environmental group, now you, on any issue, you usually get some environmental groups that don't always agree one way or the other. But
right.
Here they all agree that transportation of nuclear waste cannot be done safely.
What are the options? What else could be done besides sending it out here to us?
Let me say two things. First of all, these nuclear utilities, which have spent in the last 3 years $30 million lobbying Congress, getting campaign contributions, flying people to Las Vegas to take them up to Yucca Mountain for 2 hours and put them up here for 3 or 4 days. What we have found is that they say, well, we have to have it in one spot, so bring it to Nevada. Well, that's so ridiculous. Of the approximately 110 generating facilities we have in America today, you're never going to get rid of the nuclear waste because they continue generating it. So to say there's only going to be one spot is simply illogical. What do you do with it? Leave it where it is. That's what they're doing in various places around America today. Calvert Hills outside Boston, they're putting it in what they call dry cask storage containers. The scientists say it would be safe there for 100 years. It's cheap. It would be easier to secure it there than trying to haul it. Each one of these containers would weigh 135 tons. It would take 100,000 truckloads, 20,000 trainloads. That's 120,000 targets of opportunity for terrorists. So leave it where it is. It would be safe. It would be secure. And you wouldn't have to worry about transporting it.
And that is a solution for at least the next 100 years. And, of course, we're always looking to technology to save our butt somehow. So maybe by then we'd figure something out. Is that the idea?
That's absolutely right. We've made progress. Remember, this act that they're trying to put the stuff in Nevada based upon is 20 years old. A lot of things have happened in that 20 years. The only thing that hasn't happened is the Department of Energy, the bureaucrats down in the bowels of the Department of Energy. There may be administrations change, but the bureaucrats don't. And they have been pell-mell toward fulfilling that 1982 act, which by now is antiquated.
All right. Well, let's try this angle, Senator. You know, obviously a lot of people listening all over the country are saying to themselves, screw Nevada, just like the bill said. Maybe people should understand across the country with regard to this issue how it might be even more unsafe for them than it would be for Nevadans. In other words, the getting of it, the transportation of it, is the risky part, or at least as risky as getting it here, isn't it?
I think it's more risky.
More risky.
And I believe that, especially since September 11th, we've got to be very careful. We have a Congressman, Ed Markey, who's a longtime member of Congress today, spoke out saying the nuclear facilities, they don't even check when someone goes to work there if they're a terrorist. They let them work there for 30 days while they're running the test to find out if they're qualified to work there.
Aye, aye, aye.
And you know, they're trying to ship one of the proposals is to ship from some of the reactors in the northern part of New York, shipping them down the river, Hudson River. These things are just, they do not have a plan for transportation, so you're absolutely right on target. It would be so, so dangerous to ship it, and this is a problem that would affect 43 states. It'll go through 43 different states.
Holy mackerel. 43 states.
Yep. And there'll be about 75 million people within a stone's throw of this. This will travel by the schoolyards, people's businesses, and, of course, their homes.
How much additional facility is there for storage left to cover the next 100 years? Is it sufficient if it stayed where it was?
What they would do is take them out of the cooling ponds, as I said at Calvert Hills, what they're doing there, take them out of the cooling ponds, put them in dry cast storage containers, which is on-site storage. And certainly, we've already spent at Yucca Mountain $8 billion. And it's estimated that by the time that's finished, it would be upwards of $80 billion, some say $100 billion, whereas you can store them on site for an average of maybe $10 or $15 million per site. Think of how the savings of that to the American people and the safety factor involved. I mean, realistically, you're not going to be able to ship 135-ton casks all over America. People aren't going to allow that to happen. We have learned in years past that any time the federal government starts talking about you're okay with things nuclear, you go back to the early part of last century where they had these over-the-counter drugs that people used for arthritis and toothaches and stuff, it rotted out people's bones and killed some. Mm-hmm. We know that X-rays, they said that was safe. My father-in-law died as a 53 years old from leukemia as a result of having worked as an X-ray technician as a young man. We know the above-ground nuclear tests here in Nevada were extremely dangerous, made lots of people sick, and killed people. So when the federal government comes to us and said, don't worry, everything is going to be just fine, we're going to haul this stuff, and nobody has to worry about a thing. We're dealing with the most poisonous substance known to man, plutonium, and you can't haul it safely, especially with terrorists waiting around every corner.
And how long will this stuff have to be safely stored?
10,000 years, the way they have it now.
10,000 years?
10,000 years. That's why leaving it where it is and letting the scientists work on it. I mean, we have a number of very interesting proposals. Senator Menachie, a Republican from the state of New Mexico, and I do work together on the Energy and Water Subcommittee and Appropriations. We appropriate $22 billion a year, every year. Some of that goes to a lot of research at the labs. New Mexico has two labs. California has one. There are a number of other ones. And we think there's some really interesting things that can be done. We had a great program at Clinch River in Tennessee during the 70s and early 80s that was knocked out because they were afraid plutonium would get in the hands of the Soviets. Had we stayed on that program, we wouldn't need any Nevada test site. I mean, I'm sorry, the Yucca Mountain.
Yucca Mountain, yeah. Okay, where are we realistically, politically? Is it all over, or what are the options that are ahead of us, if any?
No, it's not all over. The recommendation, the president started a time running. The governor of Nevada now has till about the middle of April to veto this. He will do that probably in early April. It will come to Congress. Then Congress has 90 days to act on it. Both houses of Congress have to override Governor Gwynn's veto. The House of Representatives is a lost cause. That will happen automatically. Mm-hmm. But it's not going to happen automatically in the Senate. Senator Ensign and I, he's the other senator from Nevada. He's a Republican. I'm a Democrat. We're going to work to try to get some more votes.
When you count now, how does it come out?
Well, President Clinton, when he vetoed the last time they tried to do this under a different statutory framework, we were able to get 33 Democrats and 2 Republicans. With Senator Ensign there now, who is a Republican, we're hopeful that we're going to get more. I'm working hard on the Democrats. He's working hard on the Republicans. And our goal is to get 51. That's what we need. We're not there yet. We're probably in the 37 or 38, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a lot of things to do. We hope to be able to change people's minds. The 2 senators from Utah certainly should try to help us because they know what it's like to have nuclear waste jammed down their throat. They tried to do it in Indian Reservation there. We have great expectations for the 2 senators from Vermont, who hadn't voted with us before, and that's an extremely environmentally conscious state. We hope that there are 2 Democrats there, or I should say a Democrat and an independent. In New Hampshire, we have hopes there. That's turned into an extremely environmentally conscious state. So anyway, we're working on all kinds of things to get the numbers up to 51.
I've got to ask this question, and it is, if it becomes at some point absolutely inevitable, irreversible, irrevocable, it's coming here, we've lost. There are many people out there who would ask, well, some stupid person once said, if it's to be raped, then finally relax and enjoy it. Should Nevada reap benefits monetarily will Nevada reap benefits monetarily if it happens?
Once you start discussing price, you become a prostitute, no matter what the price may be. And the fact is, people who say, well, what we'll do is we won't have to pay income tax. These people are living in a dreamland. Just like New Mexico, which has low-level waste at the facility there called the WIP facility, Waste Isolation Project.
Yes.
They were promised all kinds of things. They've gotten nothing. And you know, there's nothing to give. I mean, last year we had a surplus of over $4 trillion. We now have a deficit of zero, zip, nothing. Well, where is the money going to come from? Nevada's going to get nothing for this, and that's why we shouldn't get nuclear waste.
So you don't even entertain that discussion. If all finally became lost, would you at that point work for Nevada to receive something for what it's going to be put through?
I'm a realist, and my realism tells me there is nothing there. There's nothing to give us. Why in the world would give it to us? I mean, the president's already has told us how he feels about Nevada. He's got problems with education and all kinds of things. He's not going to give any money for Nevada. It's a question without an answer that makes any sense. The answer is,
there's no money.
No, there's no money to give us. I mean, where's it going to come from? Are we going to take it from education? Are we going to take it from transportation? Are we going to take it from Pennsylvania? They'd be happy to give us their money. I mean, it won't work. So the answer is, people who think we're going to get monetary gain from this are foolish. when that repository, if that repository ever came into being, it would create less than 200 permanent jobs. Well, that many people quit a job every day at the MGM.
That's right. That's right. Maybe you would like to comment on some recent news of, and this is sort of unrelated, maybe it's related to the way you do what you do, responding to federal judges' orders. This is a lead story this hour. The Bush administration turned over thousands of documents today related to Vice President Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force. And now most of the papers were blanked out. Now, I wonder if trouble in this area, in some loose way with regard to behavior, relates to what's going on with the whole dump site.
Of course it does, and that is why that I've joined in the litigation that has been filed against the Vice President. Shouldn't we as the American people know who he met with to come up with an energy policy for this country?
You bet.
I don't think that's asking too much. We're asking who he met with, when he met with him, and where they met. We're not asking even to divulge all the information, although I think that's going to come out someday. And, you know, people said, well, aren't other presidents that you've worked with, haven't they tried to keep things secret? The answer is absolutely yes. I've worked with a lot of them. But once, I understand why they keep things close to their chest. But once they've been discovered, they just give the stuff up. But not here. There's something more than meets the eye here. I do not understand this.
Senator, we all know what politics is, and, you know, you get down to Nevada's votes, and they became, as you pointed out, really important. So they came here, and they told a lie. Have you ever been put in a position yourself, in a fight for re-election, where it came down to something like that? I mean, just having to tell somebody a bold-faced lie to get the last few votes.
Yeah, you can't do that. Now, there are times when you don't, when a person doesn't ask the right question, you know, you don't volunteer things that may not be in your interest, but you never lie. You never hide the truth. You know, I think that people, Ronald Reagan, as an example, there are a lot of things I disagreed with him politically, but I always felt that he was a person who told it the way it was.
He did.
And I admired him for that. So I don't think a person has to lie to be a successful politician. I mean, I can look at over my career, the people I've served with. Some people who are listening to this program, which covers so much area, will not remember him, but Governor Michael Callahan, who was governor of Nevada for 8 years, probably the best governor Nevada's ever had. And he's a person who would die before he would tell a lie. He's one of the most honest people I've ever known. George Mitchell, who was majority leader of the Senate.
Oh, yes.
I've served with some people who set a great example, who are certainly in keeping with what I think a member of the clergy should be, is for truth and veracity. So,
Senator, I know that we're right up against a half-hour break here. Are you able to stay for the next segment?
I'll be happy to.
Good. Good. Senator Harry Reid, our senator, my senator here in Nevada. And we're talking about all sorts of things, I guess ethics and government. Maybe we'll even talk a little bit about soft money and whether that signature really, really will go on the bill and whether it'll be a smile or a frown as he signs. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. All right. Here from, I presume, home is the amazing Brad Steiger. Hi, Brad.
Hello, Art. I appreciate that thunderclap every time you mention my name. I feel like I'm in Young Frankenstein.
Well, in some ways. Brad, on my program in the last few days, actually, and that's how current all of this is, I've been getting these remarkable, incredible stories about people who have seen. I had a police officer send me a story that I read on Friday. He and his partner saw this ball of light, first a smaller ball that moved around. You know, they had responded to an alarm that was going off in a building.
Mm-hmm.
And a small ball moved around. They thought, how odd, oddest thing they had ever seen in their life, and they were sitting there still conversing, waiting for the alarm to reset, which they do finally. And this giant ball appears with what the officer described as a almost monkey-looking, like simian-looking being inside of it, and this thing was floating. And I read this story on the air, and then all of a sudden I started getting all these calls from people who have seen similar things that are floating, some of them with what appear to be something or another inside them. There's the famous story about the ranch in Utah and what they once saw there, you know, that ranch that Bob Bigelow has.
Right.
You know, they had scientists who watched a creature come out of what appeared to be a sort of a hole that formed in midair. They did this with night vision equipment. What the hell do you suppose all this might be?
I don't know, but it's certainly, as you say, these things go in waves, because I certainly, in the last month or so, have been getting these reports. And
really?
People, yeah, saying, what is it? What is it? I've had an encounter personally with these, and had one of my best-selling books is the result of an entity that came out of a greenish ball of light.
Yeah, there you are.
And gave me the complete outline for my book, Revelation: The Divine Fire, which, you know, was Book of the Month and Literary Guild. And
No, you see, I hadn't heard all this. Now,
well, it's, you know, every time we have about 4,000 things to talk about, and I guess it's never come up before.
Well, I just slammed the most current thing on you, Brad, that people have been, at Friday night, after I told that story, I read the email on the air.
Mm-hmm.
I was just swamped with calls.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you can imagine a million things. You can imagine a dimensional portal of some sort. You can imagine time travelers, you can imagine, I suppose, even aliens. You can imagine a million different things, but you can't explain these things.
Art, I'm going to take you back to 1939. I'm going to take you back to Hollywood. I'm going to take you off to see the wizard.
Oh.
And when Glinda appears, every time there is that big shiny ball, right?
Hell yeah.
You see that ball, you see it coming closer, and then she touches, blink.
That's
and
right.
All of a sudden the ball is Glinda the Good Witch.
That's right.
So this has obviously become an archetype in our unconscious. This is a means of travel. That's why, you know, some of us have been saying for a long time now that some of the UFOs could indeed be living beings. That could be the entities. That could be the aliens.
By the way, are you blessed with having a computer separate from your telephone there or not?
Not at the moment.
Not, okay, well.
But I will check it at another computer when we take a break.
Yeah, good. Okay, you're able to do, yeah, please do that. It's under What's New. It's called Washington Photograph. It's a classic Pleiadian type craft. This looks like a really genuine photo to me, and I just would like to get your personal reaction after you've seen it. So when we go to a break, by all means do that, all right?
Right.
Okay, good. Back to these, whatever they are. You know, we are obviously being visited, or there's some concern about us, or, you know, I mean, who knows? Maybe we're a tourist stop or something.
Sure.
But something is here and now increasingly manifesting itself to be seen with these balls of light.
And the credentials of the people who have been sharing these stories with me.
Well, I know.
I mean, again, you know, not that we're slighting anybody, neither you nor I would do that, but I mean, I'm hearing from highly credentialed people, and they don't want their names known.
I know.
But they're sharing this because it's part of what we do, you know, to put this information together and get it out there. And like you say, fascinating. Some see a simian-type face sometimes. Some see a reptilian face sometimes.
That's right.
Others see like a hooded master-type face. And then others just see the glowing ball itself.
That's also correct. Many see that. Now.
Yeah. So, again, I think this is really interesting. So, Friday. Now, this, I started probably maybe 3 weeks ago, really getting an influx, and now you've been getting them for a week.
Well, my program, of course, acts, you know,
as, well, of course it does.
You know, it's kind of a lightning point for
this. It's a catalyst.
So you're going to hear about it here first,
right.
and then elsewhere. So we both began getting news of this at about the same time.
That's about the same time. Yeah, about the same time. And here again, then, this is obviously now another cycle, because these things come in cycles. Whatever we're talking about, it comes in a cycle. I've been getting a lot of reports, and this is strange, you know, here again, of a ghost in a plaid shirt, blue jeans, and like work boots, showing up in bedrooms, showing up when people are hunting, they get a tap on the shoulder, here's this fellow, they see it out. Again, a blonde, kind of nice-looking guy, and they see him for just a flash, and he's gone. Now, again, that has to be some kind of symbol. That has to be some kind of archetype that someone, call them, I call them the other, because I don't know what to call them, but the other is obviously communicating that particular image right now. The glowing ball, I am convinced, is a means of transportation, or maybe the entity itself, as the entity really looks.
All right, well, that tears it. Hold on just one sec. Let me read this to you. Here it comes. Art, you know, I've kicked the idea around for years about telling you my story. I've decided to do so only because I know you will enjoy it and maybe share it with some of your friends. Let me start out by saying that I spent a total of 20 years in law enforcement, 19 in Washington State, and about 7 months in Alaska, North Slope. I now work for private industry following the September 11 attacks. I've seen many strange things, most of which were explainable with one major exception. I was a patrol sergeant with the Issaquah Police Department. There we are, folks, Issaquah up in Washington. At the time of this event, and I do mean an event, because of the impact it had on me and the way that I looked at the supernatural. I can't tell you the exact day, but it was a cool evening back in 1989. I was supervising two other officers on this particular night. A call was received by our dispatch at about 0200 hours from one of the alarm companies advising of an intrusion alarm at a store in the Gilman Village complex. This complex is made up of dozens of old homes, which were moved to a central location in Issaquah and turned into exclusive little shops and wood walkways. I used to walk through this complex during my night patrols for exercise. That is, until this incident. I responded along with most of the patrolmen, and we checked the exterior of the building, found it to be secure. The alarm reset itself, which is normal. The other officer and myself stood in a parking lot about 50 feet away from the building, talked about various things. Midway through a sentence, I was stopped cold by a very intense white ball of light making its way across the outer wall of the building that we had just checked out. The ball was about the size of a softball and went from left to right just under the eaves of the second-story building. We both looked at each other, puzzled about what we had just seen. The light was too bright and perfectly round for it to be from an artificial source. We talked about what we had observed and looked around for any possible source. We both shrugged it off as a small mystery and continued on with our previous conversation. Within approximately 5 minutes of the original event, a ball of light, approximately 3 to 4 feet in diameter, slowly moved across the bottom of the building. However, inside the ball was what I describe as the Monkey Man. It truly looked like the shadow of an upright monkey-like creature walking inside the ball. It was another 5 minutes before either one of us could talk. We never discovered the source of this amazing sight, and I'm not sure that I really wanted to. We did not speak about it for a number of weeks to anyone, but it did become general knowledge within the department, and of course, the Monkey Man became the source of numerous ribbing for years after. And he instructs me to please go ahead and read this on the air. His first name is Randy, and I will omit his last name. That's his story, Brad. And that set off a night of, hey, I've seen one of those two type things.
Well, for a minute, I thought you were reading one that I also received because it was from law enforcement. But in this case, what was inside was sort of the archetypal mother image or Virgin Mary image.
Oh.
Now, then we, again, so much of this mystery is somehow reflecting the individual. That's not to say that this fine gentleman, you know, again, but he's in law enforcement. Maybe this is a symbol of monkey business. You know, maybe that's what he expected to see. I mean, I think it's playing with us. I think it's giving us clues and showing archetypal images. This police officer I'm referring to was going under a lot of stress and a crisis. Maybe he needed to see that, you know, there's a great mother who cares for him. You know, that particular image.
Maybe.
Now, when they... I did not... The first night this entity appeared, I woke up in the middle of the night, and here it is leaning over, waving its arms. All I see now... If someone in my field wakes up in the middle of the night and you see something in a robe moving its hands, you know, you think a lot of things. So, again, I should have, you know, metaphysical researcher or whatever, and I should have thought it was an angel. I should have thought it was a guide. But what I did was say, my home is invaded.
Maybe we should just back up a little bit. You awoke to actually see the creature in a ball or not? How did this...
Okay, I got to see. First, I had... two visitations in a row, two nights. And the first night, I jumped up and I arched back to just punch this entity as hard as I could. But my blow was never delivered. I was like a balloon. I was, suddenly all the energy was out of me. And at that time, you know, I'm pumping iron every day. I mean, I'm in really good shape at this time of my life.
But you took a swing at this thing?
Oh, I took a swing. I was going to cold cock it.
Yeah, Brad, hold on. Hold it right there. That's a great place to break. You have to ask yourself, if you were confronted with a being from somewhere else, or somewhen else, whatever it would be, dead flat in front of you, would you rear back, clench your fist and give it a good one? Or would you turn around and haul butt, or would you be frozen? I suppose any of the above reactions are possible. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Now there's the thunder, and here's Brad. All right, Brad, rarely do we get a first-hand account like the officer gave and like you're about to give. I mean, you actually went through this yourself.
It was obviously an experience I shall never forget.
So let's have it in detail.
Well, to start in detail, and this is a two-part story now. I'll move it quickly. The first night, I'm awakened. Now, remember, at this time, Art, I'm probably 34 years old. I got four babies sleeping in the house. And my wife and I, my late wife, and I are in bed sleeping. And I wake up, and here is this tall, hooded being moving his hands in a circular motion over the two of us. It's as if, you know, and so I did what I think most men would do. You know, you're protecting your family.
You're protected, yeah, you reacted.
I reacted. I got up, and like I say, at that time, I was in great physical shape, pumping iron, jogging every day, the whole thing. I could have done someone a lot of damage if I'd landed a good square blow. But it was like a balloon. I'll never forget it. I just started to crumble, and then I started to cry. Because, you know, what is more humiliating for a strong man than
to be powerless?
Powerless! Yeah. I couldn't move!
What do you think that being was doing? Waving, you said, moving its hand in a circular motion above the two of you.
I think
guesses about that?
Waking me up. Waking me up.
Waking you up.
Now, what, and this again I shall never forget. My wife remained asleep. But it was her mouth that moved, and a voice came from her, a kind of metallic voice that said, "Don't be afraid, we won't hurt you."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, I've got the kind of mind, like yours, Art, I don't shut up. When I've got a chance to question or something like this is happening, I'm going to be there and watching it. I don't remember another thing until morning. But I had all these ideas. I had all these thoughts in my head about this book I'm supposed to write. So now the next night, again, I'm going through this, and I asked my wife, didn't know, she wasn't aware of anything, and I said, well, this incredible thing happened, and gee, what was it? Now the next night, I'm lying in bed, I'm not asleep yet, and I hear what I can only describe as like a metallic bumblebee, a metallic kind of, and it's coming up the stairs.
Yeah.
And it's about the size of a soccer ball. It's a green, glowing ball of light.
Yeah, here we go.
And it turns, it stops in the hallway, moves into the bedroom, and then, zinc, here is the tall, hooded being again. So I say, now tonight, you know, there is no way you're putting the whammy on me. I'm going to have some answers here. And, of course, just like that, once again, because I jumped up again, I was ready to grab him and shake him.
Yeah.
And just every bit of energy, and again, I collapsed. But when I awakened the next morning, I had the complete outline, who I was supposed to interview, who I was supposed to talk to, what outline I was supposed to have.
And what was the book supposed to be about?
The contemporary revelatory experience. How they or whomever, how a higher intelligence is trying to convey certain messages to us. I say it's been one of my best-selling books. It's the book that wherever I go, even today, it came out in 72 or 3, people still come up and say it changed their life, it gave them comfort, it gave them inspiration.
Well, all right, give me some of it. I mean, what exactly, what are the motivations for not appearing, you know, in the famous White House lawn, on the famous White House South Lawn or whatever, but conveying the information rather in the manner in which it is apparently conveyed? Why?
Well, okay, this has a snapper ending to it.
Sure.
It isn't over yet.
All right.
Before, and this was Prentice Hall, big hardcover Prentice Hall book. I interviewed probably every leading theologian, psychologist, psychiatrist in the country for this book. Got great stuff. Before I had a copy, I received a letter from a musician in Chicago who had a copy of the book put into his mailbox with no return address, just in there. He has a copy of the book. Now, a year before, he writes to me, he had the experience with the entity.
Oh, no.
And he was told to write this book, but he's a musician. He didn't know how to do it. What I did, on that second morning when I awakened, I called my editor, Prentice Hall, and I said, Jam, I have a fabulous idea for a book, The Contemporary Revelatory Experience. And he went, wow, let's do it. The musician, you know, if he heard music, spiritual music, he could have put it down. So, Art, I think the answer is many, many people are contacted to get certain ideas and concepts out. And they already care. They didn't care if I did it. And how many others? How many others had that same experience?
Maybe he was given a preprint courtesy copy because they knew he couldn't do it.
Yeah. I mean, think of that.
Well, you know, all right, what would you say are the main components of the messages that are so urgently being dispersed through people like yourself and others who have had these experiences, so many of them?
Well, you know, that's, now that it's, 30-some years later,
mm-hmm.
I see that now the messages are, you know, continually repeated. And I guess I put it into my style and touched people at that time. I see others coming out with similar books. Now, it's basically that we are more than physical beings, that we have within us more powers, more abilities than we believe we are able to use. We can extend ourselves to become more completely functioning human beings. and that this message is continually broadcast and repeated. And since that time, I've encountered so many people. I mean, people in the big listening bowls who get like Khalil Gibran and the Bhagavad Gita broadcast from a what goes into the newspaper next day, is calling it an erratic meteor with this ball of light that keeps going back and forth, back and forth.
Yeah, but other than my program, Brad, some other programs perhaps like it, the work you do and some others do, I mean, we're still a very tiny minority. I mean,
right.
And so the larger picture is that if that's the message, it's not being received, or if it is being received, it's not being acted on. In other words, the world is going straight down a technological, perhaps even suicidal path
at a million
miles an hour.
And maybe it's supposed to. But what I want to say, to amend what you just said, remember, this book came out in 72.
Mm-hmm.
Where were you? Where was your program in 72? Nothing like it was on, see?
Yeah, no.
I mean, from my perspective.
Yeah, but I mean, all those years of essentially the same message, and we're still a tiny minority, is my point. And technologically, zoom, away we go, Element 92. I just finished talking to Senator Harry Reid before I had you on about the storage and transportation. Even more scary part, the transportation, all this nuclear crap.
Mm-hmm.
So we're racing down this technological, perhaps suicidal path, and the message, you know, that we are more than we are, and probably part of something much bigger, and
well, again,
I don't know that it's getting through.
It's much more than that, and it is getting through. I say, from my perspective, it has grown enormously.
Yep.
And I remain a cockeyed optimist. Now, I you know, even metaphysical writers get the blues, and sometimes I say, you know, exactly what you're saying. But then I look at the broader picture, and I look, we couldn't even have been having this conversation over the radio when I wrote that book.
Oh, I'm sure not.
See, and I mean, look how far we've come, and that's it. The people are out there. You get the emails, I get the emails, I get the letters, you get the letters. It is making a difference, but, you know, I've really stopped. I said to lecture audiences 10 years ago that I had resigned as caretaker of the universe. And, you know, I see now that it's where each of us, we each have to make that choice. And it's for us as individuals to have that goal. And maybe the greater society will always turn a deaf ear. Maybe that's the way it's supposed to be. But that doesn't mean we should be discouraged from keeping getting the message out. And, of course, I made it very simplistic. I mean, there's all kinds of things in the book. I mean, it's a big, fat book. But
right. But still, that's the central...
Yeah. I mean, I was saying that very, very simply, you know, that we are just more than physical beings, and that we have a spirit, and that a contact with a higher intelligence. There is someone out there who cares and interacts with us.
There is increasing evidence, Brad, with a city about 2,200 feet under the water off the coast of Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And, boy, I'll tell you, I could just rattle them off around the world, all these discoveries being made, that civilization may have been here before, and I mean, even perhaps some sort of technological civilization, and then even before that, and before that, in other words, man or beings like men could have come and gone on this planet many times. This evidence is roundly pretty much being ignored.
And that's been the subject of, you know, Mysteries of Time and Space, which came out about the same time. That is my second strongest passion, is worlds upon worlds there were before Adam was, that our civilization has been cyclical. Not only these phenomena we're talking about are cyclical, but our civilization has been cyclical. And that there was, it appears, a race of giants in prehistoric times.
Okay. What's the giants, huh?
Mm-hmm.
What's the best evidence for this kind of claim?
Skeletal remains all over the world of entities 7 to 12 to 18 feet tall.
Wow.
Found in when they're digging mines, when they're digging wells, when they're digging walls. They've been found all over the world.
Bipedal.
I mean, these are for all the world, Homo sapiens skeletons, but just very large Homo sapiens skeletons.
Where are these being found?
All over. Southwest, American Southwest, California, Texas. In Texas, they found a cave that looked like it was a nursery for, and there are a number of skeletal remains of giant females. And as I say, it happened to be naturally steam heat coming in there.
Just isn't going to mix. In other words, these skeletal remains and footprints and all the rest of it, you're suggesting go back as much as, say, 250 million years. And maybe even that's only the beginning. So, you know, Christ was here, what, a thousand plus a few years ago, and that's 1,000. You're talking about 200 50 million years. This wasn't just before Christ and Adam and Eve.
No. The footprints are two in strata indicative of 250 million years. Those are the giant footprints that have been found. The skeletal remains seem to be much more recent, probably, 100,000 or so years ago.
Uh-huh. Even that's a lot.
Of course it is.
By measure of, say, when Christ was here.
Well, I mean, we're having the enormous debate right now, the whole out of Africa, and who are we as a species, and when did we become a species? Is Neanderthal one of us, or is he a distant relative, or isn't he? Is he just a hominid? And that's the fascinating thing. Do you remember that movie, A Quest for Fire, some years ago?
Oh, sure.
Well, you remember that got a lot of criticism because it showed several hominid groups existing. Some were cannibalistic, some were, advanced, some were more like apes, and then there was Homo sapiens questing for fire. But now, that proved to be, a precursor of what we're finding now, and some suggest, some very credentialed scientists suggest that there may have been as many as 12 hominid species coexisting at the same time. And we somehow, was it our wits, was it our luck, was it our generosity, or was it our evilness that destroyed the other species? Why are we here and they aren't?
Well, almost everybody in the audience has read Genesis. And that would seem to instruct the manner in which all of this happened, and not nearly so long ago as you're talking about. Now, when you are confronted with people who say, no, look, read the Bible, it's all there for you, and that tells you exactly how it's happened that we are here, and there was nothing before that. There wasn't anything. There wasn't light, there wasn't time, space, planets, there wasn't anything until God moved his hand. There wasn't anything at all. And this argues with all of that. I mean, it really does. There's no way around
it. No, it doesn't, because that's Adamic civilization. That's the Adamic world. And I'm perfectly comfortable with that. That's the world of Adam. That's who we are. But as I say, the rabbinical text has always inspired me. Worlds upon worlds there were before Adam was. So here again, our Adamic world, I can be very comfortable with the creationists who say, and I got some fabulous photographs from the creationists and some of the research and discoveries that they have made. I can be comfortable saying that...
They have made some amazing discoveries.
They have indeed.
I've seen them, too. I've seen some of these photographs that are that are inexplicable. So they have science on their side as well.
Yes. Dr. Clifford Burdick, before he passed away in Tucson, sent me some incredible photographs of these giant humanoid footprints in the same strata as the great reptiles. Now, here again, that knocks people right off their seats, What are we talking? Alley-oop and Diney the dinosaur,
Alley-oop.
but again, I think what we're talking about is probably visitors. You see, we can't move away from the hypothesis completely, Art, that these giants could have come from elsewhere.
Well, they may have been coming then, as they came now, or maybe they were here in great numbers at that point, or, gosh, who knows, this is total speculation. But what's not speculation are the artifacts.
The artifacts, the pots, the pans, weapons, the swords, the hatchets, the axes, and these incredible skeletons, some 8 feet tall, some with horns, and
horns?
Some with double rows of teeth.
Horns?
Horns.
Men, giants with
yes.
horns?
Yes, with double rows of teeth, and some in Death Valley. They were found with the on their spine. They
had Death Valley, here where I am, you mean that Death Valley?
Yeah, Death Valley, which was once a harbor, which was once a very lush area. And they found huge skeletons there of 7 feet tall females, and their spines had buds, which indicated they had tails.
Tails?
Tails.
Well, gee, there's one for the evolutionists.
Yes, there is.
Tails.
Yes, there is.
Brad, hold on. We're up at the top of the hour. Tails, huh? There's a scientist who says he can give us tails now, not only wings, but tails too. That's another story.
You get a shiver in the dark, it's raining in the park, but meantime.
So we'd be getting our tails again.
Sound of the river, you stop and you hold everything.
Once again, here is Brad Steiger. Brad, when you talk about giants and, you know, 7 and 8 feet tall giants, and I don't know about horns and tails, but giants certainly would call to mind, I mean, what are all these reports of Bigfoot, after all, if not either a relative of, a relic of, or in some way related to what we're talking about right now? What do you think?
I think we have to think about that. We were hoping the special would be 90 minutes long, but Discovery Learning Channel said an hour, and in the half hour you won't see, we did go into the Bigfoot giant link.
So unfortunately, Bigfoot suffered on the cutting room floor when you had to go to an hour.
But we did get the ETs in there, and the possibility, and Alex Hamilton Brown, that put this together, went to Russia and Israel and recorded some recent sightings there where giants had been seen, close encounter situation after UFO touchdowns. But yes, I think we have to at least consider
the possibility
that there should be, the possibility that there's some link up, and that some of these skeletal remains might be more Sasquatch, Bigfoot type creatures than. But again, they are probably hominids. I mean, they are certainly.
Did anything like this, Brad, survive the Great Flood? In other words, there were the Nephilim and. God was very upset about all that and flooded everything. Noah took off of, you know, what was left that was clean that could reproduce and, you know, that whole story. So, would the giants have survived?
Well, there again, I'm glad you brought that up because we have to distinguish the Nephilim would be the godmen or the demigods. That they, again, people have made the association there with extraterrestrials. They saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and you're familiar, and I think most of our listeners are with that. The Rephaim are the physical giants. Nephilim, when they reproduced with Earth women, they produced men of great renown, which may be, you know, whether it's psychic abilities or great powers. But the Rephaim, then, are the Anakim and the Hittite and those tribes of giants. Now, Goliath was a Gittite, and there were five brothers in that family, and they were about 9 to 10 feet tall. They hired themselves out as mercenaries, and that's why they're fighting with the Philistines at this particular time. And the great encounter when the little shepherd boy comes with his sling. So we show... Alex shows in the special what may be the grave of Goliath, and he does a marvelous job of tracing that. In addition to our participation, of course, you've got Zachariah Sitchin and Eric Von Daniken and Jim Mars and several other people lending their expertise. And a very fascinating doctor, Dr. Carl Baugh, who has created a biosphere that he believes would simulate atmospheric conditions at the time of the great reptiles or when this giant species could have existed.
Right.
So, you see, at that time, then, there would have been more favorable atmospheric conditions. There would have been greater oxygen. There would have, the ozone layer wouldn't have been perforated. Would have been a lot thicker. Now, he has then simulated what he thinks would be our prehistoric environment and has put species of fish and so forth in there and is creating giants. What would be normally a 3 or 4 inch fish is now 22 inches long in this particular environment.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, and that is shown in the special, and I think that's very
interesting. That is very interesting. Interesting. Where did he create this biodome?
We have Dr. Antelman, who is in Israel at the Weizmann Institute, and I believe Dr. Baugh is in Canada.
Canada, all right. And so they actually simulated conditions as we know they would have been.
Yeah, as we know they would have been.
And
he's creating giants. I mean, of lower species. He doesn't have any people in there. But,
uh-huh.
But I think that's very fascinating. I think it's very intriguing research.
I do, too. And certainly a richer oxygen mixture would have been needed.
Mm-hmm.
Probably a more tropical, probably... much more moisture, and as you point out, the ozone layer would have been fully intact, so there wouldn't have been as much radiation.
So, I mean, could we really have a Jurassic Park today? Could we have these huge Tyrannosaurus Rex and so forth running around in our present atmospheric conditions? Probably not. Or they would still be here. Now, again, there's another mystery. What wiped out the dinosaurs? And, of course, you can hear endless debate, you know, was it an asteroid shower, was it a comet, or did they just outlive their time on the great stage? These footprints we're talking about, though, of giants predate. They would be in the age of amphibians rather than the giant reptiles. Of course, now they argue they might have been giant mammals, you know, they're early warm-blooded rather than cold-blooded, so... So many of our great sacred cows that we have cherished are being demolished.
Maybe all baloney. Speaking of outliving your environment, you know, there have been a couple of interesting stories that I've been covering heavily lately. One of them is the collapse of the Larsen Ice Shelf in the Antarctic, which was incredible. I don't know if you've seen the photographs from satellite yet of it, but the collapse of Larsen B was astounding. Just all this ice, kaboom, shattered in 30 days. Now Larsen C is unstable. And at the North Pole, the Navy just gave us a report saying they expect there will be a full sea. There will be no more ice at the North Pole. It's we've already, in the last decade or two, eliminated 40% of the ice at the North Pole. And they say there will be a new ocean there. And so things are really changing rapidly, and I wonder if we're not in the process of outliving our own environmental change.
Well, we have to concede that we are the only species that can self-destruct. I mean, and there's no guarantee that we will not go the way of the dodo bird if we're not careful.
Exactly. And you have to wonder, in millions and millions of years, whether somebody's going to be picking at our bones saying there were these short little guys. You know, and we know they used to be alive, but mainstream science, of course, will be denying it then.
That's right.
They deny it now. So many things put up on the shelf and just sort of registered as, we can't figure it out, don't know what it is, doesn't fit into our paradigm, so out you go.
Out it goes. It never existed. Well, again, with the giants, I started collecting this material in the 60s, and I'm sitting here now. I have at least 10 pages single-spaced of where gigantic skeletons of giants have been found, which, of course, would not make good radio to sit and read it. But, again, I'm just continually, and I know... You raised it before. Why don't we know more about these?
Well, yeah, wouldn't there, for example, no matter how it came down, wouldn't there, for example, have been probably some period of time where giants met what is now or was relative of modern man. In other words, where both existed at the same time.
Well, again, the Bible has many such stories. And again, there are on the special. Pardon me, I'm not trying to be horribly gratuitous with the plugs.
You can plug it all you want.
but we have a rabbinical scholar, you know, again saying that this is very much and very solidly stated in the writings of the Hebrew that. Well, and we mentioned the Anakim, we mentioned the Gittite, we mentioned the difference with, you know, the Nephilim and the Raphaim. Well, one we think of very often is when Moses, when they're leaving Egypt in that traditional story, and he sends Joshua and some other scouts on to Hebron. And remember, they come back and they say, they're huge.
Yes.
We're like grasshoppers.
Yes.
And so we have a number of such accounts.
You also found giant skeletons somewhere in graves in Minnesota. What's that all about?
Oh, enormous amount. And I think we have to go back. There is the Allegheny Mountains are probably named for the Allegiwi. The Allegiwi were a tribe of giants that continually warred in the eastern states where the Delaware and the Iroquois are. So that would be, you know, the upstate New York and the New England area.
Right, of course.
And they would not permit them to pass. The Delaware tried to conquer them, but again, these were giants. Eventually, though, the tribes kept at them, and they wandered as far as Minnesota. And there, the Minneconjou Sioux, and we know that the Sioux were mighty warriors, they defeated them. And I think that a lot of the graves that we have in Minnesota of these 7-foot, 8-foot giants would be the Allegiwi.
Then there ought to be a lot of Sioux legends, shouldn't there?
Yes, and there are Sioux legends. They tell of when the giant people came from the east, and the Delaware and the Iroquois talk about, you know, how the giants terrorized them for so long. So they're in the Native American myths. Or legends, or folklore, or oral history. Oral history, that's the best.
I can see how you might get some biblical students to perhaps agree with you that all of this might be possible. But there are many, and I've interviewed them here, Brad, who think that man did not walk upon this earth until 6,000 years ago, period. End of story. That's it. 6,000 mm-hmm. years. That's when man first stepped upon the earth.
Mm-hmm. I have sat in their classrooms.
Now, you
remember my background.
Well, so there you are. So I mean, there is a large group that is just going to go, this is just ridiculous, not possible, you're just telling stories.
No, I think and even when I was sitting in their classrooms hearing that these things could not be, I kept saying, even then, back in 1953, what about all the skeletal remains? What about the artifacts? What about the relics that people are digging up? So again, I'm at peace with it. Worlds before worlds there were before Adam was. We have our Adamic world, which we are a part of, and that began roughly 6,000 years ago in Sumer and then spread to the Tigris-Euphrates, throughout the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. And that is the people who we are. We came from Sumer.
Well, then would you say that it would be fair to say that to at least shake your head in possible agreement with what you're saying, you'd have to be a fairly liberal Bible scholar?
Well, but again, certainly the creationists with their discovery of the giant tracks and so forth, they surely recognize, or at least the ones I've corresponded with, the existence of giants. I think the point you're making, Art, is that they're not going to push it back beyond 6,000 or 7,000 years.
That's right. And, yep. and here's all the evidence that goes back.
Right. And there again, a person has to make his choice, you know. Can you see a compromise? Can you see a way of rectifying the physical evidence with your spiritual beliefs? Because that's what they would be. So you have the physical and the material, you have the spiritual and the non-material. Does it make a difference? If you it really destroys your faith, you know, then goodness me. from my perspective, it doesn't, and it never has.
All right, Brad, there are, in today's world, really tall people.
Right.
Usually basketball players.
Right.
7 feet. I mean, you know, like up around 7 feet, right?
Right.
We've got human beings on Earth right now.
Right.
That big.
Right.
Would these be more genetically close to what once was than are the rest of us, or what?
Well, again, that topic is dealt with in the special. There is the genetic giant, and then what is that? Well, I hate to say disease, but it's in a sense a disease. This, you know, the acromegaly. The people grow 9 feet tall, but you know they really they have trouble walking. Their internal organs are usually not in very good shape.
Right.
And they're really not well, and they, you know, God bless them, generally don't live much beyond 30 or so, 35, 40. Some, of course, have, but they suffer, and they're walking around with canes and crutches. Then we do have the seven-footers. I think it's interesting, you know, when I was young, my friends who were 6'5" and 6'6" didn't go out for sports because it was just decreed anyone that tall was too clumsy.
Yeah.
He wasn't coordinated. So the center in the basketball team, you know, if he was 6'1", he was, you know.
Sure.
And I think it's interesting how we have made this incredible discovery that some people 6'9" and 7 feet can move and can be graceful and can be coordinated. So there is the genetic, and the question has to be raised, are they carrying the genes of the giants?
Hold it right there. We'll be right back. I'm Art Bell. Brad, the graves of the giants in Minnesota, have any of them been dug up?
Yes, I'm going to get used to that thunder. I'm going to have to carry a little recording around if I enter a room or something.
Thunder. Yeah, it's a grand entrance, eh?
It's a great entrance. Mm. Yes, in Dresbach, Minnesota, just not too far from where I'm sitting right now, they were improving, expanding their building.
Mm.
And all of these graves then have been dug legitimately. Sometimes, and I say that because, as you know, both Sherry and I are very passionate about Native American causes, and a couple times I've been called in to kind of arbitrate when burial grounds or mounds are in the way of highways and so forth. And we feel there has to be respect there. So some were in the mounds. Some of those very large, 8-9 feet tall with horns and so forth. Some of those were in Ohio. Some of those were in other parts of the Midwest. In Minnesota, they were expanding their brick factory, and they came upon these huge skeletons, 8-9 feet tall, and inside the grave buried with them were things like metal frying pans and artifacts.
Metal frying pans?
Yeah, yeah. And in some of these mounds, Art, they have found metal implements, eating implements, knives, forks, and so forth. Now, that just, again, doesn't fly into what we know of the Native American tribes people.
Oh, no.
Now, another thing that I find very convincing are the ancient coal mines that our coal miners have dug into at enormous depths. Now, just visualize this. You're a miner, you're sinking the shaft, you're going along, and all of a sudden you break through to another shaft. Well, who's been there? And when you break through, the coal that's exposed in this other shaft is so old that it's crumbled. Now, again, we know there were no Native American tribes that sunk deep shafts and used coal.
Right.
The same thing have been found in copper mines in Michigan, where they have dug in and found old mines again, and found smelters. Now, again, who we know that the Native American tribes...
Indeed
did,
not.
It, no. Did not
so, so, so then what do the miners usually do with the evidence?
That's a good story. I'm glad many of them write letters and send me photographs of them, but I don't know. I suppose they go into museums in the area or whatever, but some of the accounts that I have received from miners are just astonishing, the things they have found. Pots and pans and pot-bellied stoves and again, things that we don't really know what they are, plus impressions of skeletal remains in coal mines.
All right, and you've, I guess there's also something about an Indian mound where 68 men,
right,
that's a lot, of that's over lot. 7 feet in height,
right,
were found, and they had horns,
yes,
and double rows of teeth, you
right.
say. Is that really true?
That is really true, and a couple mounds have been found, not with as many as the one with 68, but...
Where was that?
It was in Ohio.
Ohio.
And numerous of them. Ohio is it, you know, it's one of the heaviest states for UFO sightings. And
that's right.
All kinds of interesting things. I have some dear friends who live in Ohio, and continually strange things happen in that state. And strange things happen all over, as we know.
They do. Speaking of that, did you see that Issaquah photograph?
Yes. My dear wife heard us talking and
brought it up for you.
Yeah, and printed it out.
Brand new photograph.
If that is real, amigo, that is a fantastic photograph.
You know what hit me about it was that it's you can see, you have perspective because you've got the trees, and so you know the size of the trees.
Right.
And you can see roughly the distance to the trees, and then this is obviously in the sky way behind the trees, so it gives perspective to it. I don't know.
It looks Palladian, as you say, and it also reminds me of the George Stock series of photographs from Passaic, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And you're familiar with those?
I am.
Yeah, I know
yes,
you are.
Very similar. And so, I don't know. Do we imagine a connection... Do we imagine a connection between ufology, these things that are obviously seen, we've got photographs of them, and the existence, I mean, have they been here that long, for example?
Oh, yes.
Do you think the giants were, we have ample evidence of people who have seen flying things since as long as man could carve the
right.
image of flying things into rocks.
That's right. I think... And in that extraordinary book that will soon be re-released in quality paperback, The Source.
Oh, yeah.
As we state there, my friend, whatever the UFO mystery is, you know, it's an integral part of who we are. And it goes back farther than we are and coexists with us.
Well, I think we had it right in The Source. I still think we had it right in The Source. I think there is... somewhere, some commonality that
yes.
explains all of this.
Yes.
Now, lately, scientists have been talking a great deal about this non-locality business. I don't know if you've been keeping up with that or
mm-hmm.
not, but that everything, literally, is connected
yes.
at some level that we don't feel and interact with and understand for the most part, except occasionally.
Well, and again... I feel shame tonight, all the gratuitous plugs I'm making, but... Many people have written to me in regard to The Source saying that the exciting throughout, but the last chapter is worth the price alone, where we tie it all together
sure.
and say exactly that, where
sure.
it is all connected.
Yeah, that's right, that it's all connected.
All
and,
connected.
And now...
You can't separate it.
And now, well, you know, I talk to the remote viewers.
Mm-hmm.
I think they probably navigate in a source of non-locality. I think that... all kinds of things may exist in this non-locality, and everything exists
Absolutely.
In this non-locality. So a single source may be absolutely true in the end.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you think, and I've asked you this over many programs, that the veil is lifting or thinning, or that more and more of this appears to be going on, and we're headed towards some sort of a revelation-like event?
You've asked me that many, many times, as you said, and I think my answer has been a little different each time. This time I'm going to say, to me, the evidence is extraordinarily firm that the veil is becoming exceedingly thin, and I think we are in a cycle where people are having such incredible experiences. People who didn't dream of having them, who even scoffed at them, are having profound spiritual, metaphysical experiences. I think the veil is becoming very, very thin. And now you're going to ask what I think that means. And I think it's the fact that the seen and unseen world, or the shadow world, as I call it, with the shadow people, is becoming more and more visible. And I think it's not just happening. See, before, it was happening to people of a certain sensitivity, a certain rapport.
Now it's happening to policemen.
Exactly. It's happening to everybody.
That's right. Yes, that's right. And then this. When we talk about the non-locality, we might be talking about a collective unconscious. You know about the Princeton experiments,
right.
I'm sure,
right.
That seem to prove there is such a thing. And with respect, again, to the giants, is it possible that the giants survive in our collective unconscious? That when you and I sit here and talk about them and people sit out there listening to our talk about these, they know at some subconscious level that what we're saying is true.
I believe that very firmly. And I think one evidence, Art, that we have to mention are the huge city structures around this planet.
Yes.
With building blocks 500 tons and more. That nothing we have today without extraordinary technology can even budge.
Could do it, yeah.
And in areas where there's no trees, and even taking the very huge stones, and the only place those stones are found are many, many miles, sometimes hundreds of miles away. How could they get up to the top of the Andes?
Do you believe that the man who built the Coral Castle down in Florida had an understanding of the perhaps ancient technology that did this?
That is the most extraordinary. We just happened to see that again just a couple of weeks ago.
Did you really?
And I don't know how many times I've seen a documentary or an examination of it.
Right.
And it's just continually fascinating. And you know, he was no giant, was he?
Oh,
I mean, he was
no.
A very small man.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, he really did build that. And
yes.
This is not millions of years ago, folks. This is just, you know, fairly recent.
Yes.
Some of the stones, they just couldn't have been moved, and then he moved the whole damn thing.
The whole thing?
Yeah, it's beyond any...
No one knows. No one has... He never told anybody. No one ever saw him doing it.
Right. It must be that he in some way stumbled upon some old technology...
Or...
I call it technology, but yeah. It's, you know, it not technology as we know it.
No, no. Or he tapped in, as we're just talking, to that great unconscious, which has all secrets.
Yeah. That's right.
But he did it.
That's right, which has...
See, there we have the physical proof.
We're not
just talking hypothetically. Could it be done? Could a man tap into the ancient secrets and build a huge castle where all the rocks, the huge boulders, are balanced?
He must have.
But see, we have the physical proof.
There is no other answer. He must have.
Yeah, we needn't be hypothetical here. We have.
But you know something interesting to wonder about? The proof aside, you know, we've got the physical proof, sure. But why do you suppose that a man like that who did what he did, and obviously knew what he knew, would choose not to share it with a world that was headed down a very different path?
Here again, I'm going to give a cornball answer. I think it was love. He built it for love. I think that was his raison d'etre. I think that was why he did it, and that was complete for him. He did it as a pay-on to the woman he was never able to marry, and it was a complete gift then to the world. And that's, I think he was satisfied.
But the real gift to the world would not have been another wonderment. From the way some people would think about this, they would think, look, if he had discovered that, why didn't he give the power to do that to the world instead of just giving the world a sort of another Giza plateau, and another reason to say, we don't understand this, here's the physical proof it was done, we don't know how to do it, and we don't understand it, so there must have been something. He could have given us the secret. I wonder what kind of thought process he went through before he died in deciding not to give it to us.
Well, one can only wonder, but again, I think what he did will continually provoke thought and provoke people to ask why, and someone is going to tap into what he did and replicate it.
Maybe. Maybe. Maybe not in our lifetimes.
No. Maybe not.
Maybe the truth is that in the wrong hands, that power that he knew about, that he discovered, that he manipulated, obviously, he was concerned that we were already on a self-destructive course with our own technology, and what would we do with something as outlandish as that?
Well, remember, he was literally beaten to death by someone who wanted to get that secret.
That's exactly right, yes.
And that may have been exactly it, Art. He felt, if these brutes are beating me to find this secret, they're not ready yet.
Exactly. So maybe he was right. And you have to ask yourself, if you knew that secret, if you had within your grasp that power, considering the present state of our society, could you safely let it loose? Yourself. Could you?
I would be exceedingly cautious and very reluctant.
Yeah.
Exceedingly cautious.
And you'd probably end up getting beaten to death.
Well, I wouldn't care for that.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, you know, in the coming up hour, I'm sure we're going to get some calls on this, on the Giants, on the subject of the Giants, and perhaps also on these balls of light and energy and whatever, and these openings that continually appear.
Right.
And I would hope that we would get calls like that. I'm sure we will, in fact. And I would like that. So if you all will sort of get ready, if you do have a reason to be sort of underscoring what we're saying tonight with your own story, we very much appreciate that.
Very much so.
Then again, there's you mentioned Death Valley, and evidence of beings with spine of tails. Did you know that there are occasionally, and this is not much talked about, Brad, but occasionally there are human beings born with tails, or parts of tails, or entire tails, and do you know what? They're surgically removed, very quietly. Nobody talks about it. Nobody wants to talk about it. It's the way cancer used to be non-talked about. You know, you just, cancer, oh my God, you didn't talk about that in the family. Well, you certainly don't talk about tails, definitely, but they're surgically removed, even today.
And not always all of it. We had a hired man who worked for us who was born with a residual tail.
Really?
Yeah.
And he
I saw it with my own eyes.
You did?
Yes.
Did you speak with him about it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this was...
What had
his... This was during WW2, so when he went into the Navy, he had surgically removed.
I see. So what had his doctors told him about it? Do you recall?
Just, I mean, we're going, you know, as I say, this was WW2, so... were in that time context, and he was very good-natured about it. He laughed about it. He, you know, wasn't reluctant to moon you and show you the tail.
Uh-huh.
And I just hope someone from the hometown isn't listening now, because that's not what I'm talking about. Well,
okay, but I mean, did the doctors actually go that far out on a limb to say it was a residual tail, or it was just
I remember my father explaining to me that, you know, this did happen from time to time.
Not that it was just some abnormal growth, but that it was actually a residual tail.
Yeah, right.
Big difference there.
That's why when I see these, you know, giants and we have in our collection a photograph of the skeletons and, you know, the tail buttons and so forth, I accept that, you know, this was part of the evolutionary structure for at least some of the humanid and hominid species. And then the big thing is, did it all just disappear? Did the various hominid species, or some say they couldn't possibly have interbred, and then others say, well, of course they did.
My guest is Brad Steiger, and as I mentioned a moment ago, if you have any stories in this arena, we want to hear from you tonight. And it's kind of a continuation of last week when we were talking about this and or the Giants. We're open for business. Phone lines next with Brad Steiger. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Once again, from the rumbling thunder emerges Brad Steiger. Hey, Brad.
I got to get one of those. Young Frankenstein?
Yeah.
I love that movie.
Yeah, so
and the Cloris Leachman character. Frau Brüller, there's a thunderclap and the horse whinnies.
You know, on stage you would combine that thunderclap with a little bit of smoke, you know, and you emerge from the smoke at the right moment.
Emerge from the smoke.
All right. Let's go to the phones. I've hogged you long enough. Wildcard Line, you are on the air with Brad Steiger. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Art. Good morning, Brad.
Hi.
Brad, this is Dave from San Jose. I'm the guy that keeps calling you over the last 4 or 5 years every time you're on the show about these hooded beings. Because that was my first memory as a child seeing one of them.
Yes.
And then you were mentioning that the veil is thinning, extremely thin.
Yes.
And tonight when you were telling your story, I was thinking the same thing myself, because over all those years, I couldn't get you to give me any information on these people, on these sort of beings, even though you had a survey going with, I think, 25,000 people. I really appreciate you describing that that story that you had with them. You also mentioned that in those spheres, besides people seeing reptiles and, things, they also you mentioned Hooded Master.
Yes.
That's interesting. And, okay, so that's one question, if you can explain that. And my second one is that book, after you met this hooded being, it's called, I want to get this straight, Contemporary Revelatory Experience?
That's what it's about. The title is Revelation, the Divine Fire.
Revelation, the Divine Fire. That's really a neat title.
Yeah, it, here again, you know, I started to say about the musician.
Yes.
Okay, so I called mine Revelation, the Divine Fire. Let's see, he called his something very similar to that, but then I begin with a quote from the prophet Jeremiah that says, there is a burning fire within my heart. That's how I opened the book. He opened it with the original poem that said, within my heart a fire burns forever. I mean, that's how close the seed, I call it the great seed cloud. That's how close it was between this musician and myself.
He mentioned the hooded masters.
Yeah, the hooded beings.
Is
Dave still on?
No.
Oh, well, I thought I sent Dave material. I'm sorry. He said I hadn't sent him anything. I thought I had.
There's so much on the subject.
Yeah. And I think I indicated that. And, gee, Dave, I know you're still listening, so email me and you know, we'll keep in touch on it, because as Art just said, the veil is getting thinner with the hooded beings, right, Art?
Yes, it makes my job actually much easier, because it's like I have too much to report on every night. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Brad Steiger. Good morning.
Hi, this is Lee.
Hello, Lee.
Hi, Lee.
I'm in Indianapolis, And I've been listening a long time, but I had to call because recently I've been hearing a lot about the spheres or the
yes.
the ball.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, about 10 years ago when I was living in Washington, D.C., right on 16th Street, about 24 blocks from the White House, I had my back to the wall that divides the kitchen from the living area. And my neighbor from down the hall and my 18-year-old daughter, we were all standing there in like a little conversation circle. In the middle of the we were talking about finding a bigger apartment. And all of a sudden, this ball at eye level, traveling, oh, I don't know, I guess you'd say about maybe 10 miles an hour. It's kind of hard to judge that, but it's moving, right?
Mm-hmm.
It comes from the direction of the window. When we first spotted it, it was coming from that direction. I didn't see it actually come through that window because I didn't spot it till it was actually in the room. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
My back was to it.
Right.
Okay, it comes around, goes between us. My daughter and the neighbor lady were across from me in our conversation. We were only a few feet apart. And I'm on one side. It's like it circled around me and then went out the kitchen window. And as we were talking, we all just stopped talking, kind of looked at it, looked at each other, and followed it with our eyes as it went out the kitchen window and said, "What was that?"
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was like, but it didn't give us fear or anything. I didn't notice anything bluish, and I didn't see any monkeys in it. I saw an energy of light, a ball of energy and light.
What color?
I just, light. If anything, I'd say white or yellow.
Okay.
But no blue. But you know what I attributed to at the time? I had to come back from California a few weeks before that. And left my pet dog with a friend in California to keep as their pet. But they had to go to China, and so they had the dog boarded out with a friend of theirs. And when they came back, they told me the dog had escaped. Well, I went crazy calling all the dog pounds, Humane Society, everything I think of to try to locate my dog. Well, she was never found, so I thought, it came to me like, well, maybe it was the spirit of my dog. You know, that's what I thought it was. I started listening to your show. And now everybody's seeing these balls. And, you know, the funny thing is, not funny, ha-ha, but...
funny, strange.
When the World Tower buildings went down, okay, if those were energy balls that could... so many people died at one time.
All right. Now, ma'am, hold on. She raises a really good point. This is it's a very sensitive subject, and I'm not sure if it relates, but it may well relate. At the site of the World Trade Center disaster, a number of police officers and firemen have taken photographs. And some of the most incredible photographs, Brad, these orbs, so-called.
Right.
We've got entire collections on my website of these orbs, these balls of light that show up in photographs. I'm not sure if they relate to the physical balls of light that people are seeing or not, but the suggestion is so obvious that, so many died there and that it has something to do with the people who died there, Brad. They're energy from the other side of the veil, and that's the way they're manifesting, and not so different than the physical balls that people are describing.
Now, we must at this point mention the phenomena of ball lightning, which I'm sure have.
Oh, yes.
Yes. And it is distinctly different, because if one of the ladies in her story would have got too close, I mean, there would have been burnt hair and sin.
Absolutely.
But that is a strange phenomena that really can't be replicated in the laboratory that I know of, that scientists have been studying seriously, or at least recently. They used to scoff at it, but now it's happened enough. It's come into airplanes. It does seem to be able to go through windows.
Oh, here's one for you, Brad. There is a scientist, I heard Whitley interviewing the scientist on Dreamland. He has now proven that what are called plasma balls, which exist in the atmosphere,
right,
inexplicably are able to maintain or even increase their strength in the atmosphere. Now, whatever would create something like this, in the normal law of physics stuff, right, you would explain, you would imagine would diminish with time, but they have actually proven in the lab that these plasma balls, whatever they are able to either maintain their size or increase in size, and there's nothing to explain that.
No. So we have a natural phenomenon, which is very difficult to explain at this moment in space and time, and then we have what I think we are believing and conceding is a spiritual phenomena. The orbs from the other side that represent either the vehicles with which the visitors, the other, travel or manifest, and then the spirit of those who have gone to the other side.
And there may be an absolute relationship.
I have to always believe that.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Brad Steiger and Art Bell. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi, Brad. Hi.
Hi.
Art. You were talking about people with tails. I have a pair of extra nipples, and they're only teeny tiny, like way even littler than baby size. I bet they're a quarter inch across maybe, but they're just 2 inches under regular ones, and they never grew, thankfully, but they're there. And
As for example, a dog would have a whole line of nipples, right?
Yeah.
And so, and I'm in no way comparing you to a dog. But it may be that at another earlier time, but that's really fascinating. What do your doctors tell you about that?
I've never asked, and you can't really see them unless you really put your face, like standing close by.
Right.
So I've never really listened.
Doctors have never commented or said anything to you?
No, I've never, I guess they never really look close enough. They kind of look maybe just like a birthmark, or just, unless you look close enough to see. If you want me to, I can, next time I'm by my brother, take a digital photo and...
By all means.
I just send it along.
Yes.
By all means.
So, but where are these things from? Are they like, maybe some people survived in ancient, from ancient, all those past civilizations, and some little bits of DNA were passed down somehow?
The extra nipple thing is quite apart from the other things we're discussing. I have heard one time or another from women who had one extra nipple, but the fact that you have
two
right beneath, again, and, I will say as Art did, no comparison, but we know, of course, that there are other mammals who do have rows of nipples, and that's, I'm amazed that a doctor has never commented on it.
Maybe when I was little, but I don't remember, but nothing lately.
But again, that's extraordinary, and what it means, the vestigial tail, we know that many evolutionists believe that at one time our evolving species did have tails, but I don't know of any of the greater apes or monkeys or any of our hominid cousins who have rows of nipples, other than, dogs and cats and that type of thing.
Please, by all means, send the photograph.
Okay. And then you say, if I ask the doctor, what would the doctor say? I mean...
Well, I know, that's what we want to know.
Yeah, that's why we were asking. What?
So next time you go to the doctor, show him.
Okay.
And ask him.
I'll ask him.
I'd be very interested in the response. In the meantime, if you would send along that photograph. First time caller line, you're on the air with Brad Steiger and Art Bell. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. Good morning, Brad.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Bob. I'm listening to you at WLS out of Chicago.
Hey, Bob.
And in August of 81, I used to spend my summers out by my cousins. And that summer, he told me about a ball that's been hanging around his house. I thought he was just trying to scare the crap out of me. And I was about 15 at the time. And we were coming back from a swimming party, probably about 9:30 at night. I had a brand new pair of glasses on. We both weren't drinking anything. And we were coming parallel on the next block over from his house. And I see this light, this ball of light. He's like, there it is, there it is. So we turned off the lights, turned the corner. We're creeping up on this thing, and it's just hovering under the window in the kitchen where my parents and his parents were. And this thing shot out in front of us, in front of the street, maybe about 25 feet up above the ground. We turned the lights on, and this thing moved at a velocity that I have never seen anything move before in my life. It was a fluorescent green. About the size, maybe a little smaller than a stop sign, a little bigger than a basketball. Didn't change size at all. But after we had both seen it, it had never came back. They had seen it earlier that week. Just one person had seen it, and then they'd tell the other person. Like, but nobody's seen it, both, you know, two people, until me and my cousin, and then it never came back. But this thing moved, and I tell you, it was aware of us. It was definitely aware of us.
How do you know that?
Because it darted out in front of the car, and as soon as we turned the lights on, it went. And it moved through the branches of the trees, maneuvered through the branches of the trees at a velocity you wouldn't believe. It was incredible.
Yeah. Again, I don't know what we're dealing with here, but I had an experience when I was a teenager. I'm a farm boy originally, small Iowa town, and I'm doing chores one night, and I hear girls screaming at the end of our lane. And I can make out three girls, and again, you know, small town, so I could figure out who they were, but I could not imagine why they were screaming.
Sure.
So I asked them, next time I went into town in my 41 Chevrolet, I said, you know, why were you girls screaming at the end of our lane? And they said, oh, a ball of light, a green ball of light came up and the end of our lane was really marshy, a lot of swamp, and they said it came out of the marsh there and chased us for almost all the way back to town. That's why we were screaming.
Well, you can almost hear millions of people saying swamp gas at the same time.
Yeah, but I mean, this is before swamp, you know, you thought of those things, but it could have been Will-O-The-Wisp or, you know, Firefox or whatever. So I thought, well, that's a good story. So one night I'm driving home after dark, and there it is in front of my car. And again, just as this gentleman is describing, in the headlights. But this thing came right at me and went right through my windshield and right out the rear window.
Oh, my. Brad, hold it right there. Right through the car. Just like that. What do you guys think we're dealing with anyway? I'm Art Bell. We'll be right back. Brad, if you're ready, here they come.
Here they come.
First time caller line, you're on the air with Brad Steiger. Good morning.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello, this is John from Orlando.
Yes, John.
Yes.
Hi, John.
Hello. I've been down to Coral Castle, and I took a bunch of pictures. Actually, before he even brought it up on the show, I was a big fan of his. So I went down there and took pictures, and he actually created a magnetic wheel. Nobody talks about this. One of the main things, if you go down there right now, it's still there right now in the museum.
A magnetic wheel.
Yeah, and what's weird about it is, do you remember the Canadian guest that you had?
Yes.
That made that magnetic wheel that he
talked
about?
Yes, from Vancouver, I believe, yes.
The setup, the numbers, combinations of magnets were divided in half on this, on his wheel, on the Coral Castle wheel.
That's interesting.
Yeah, that's what made me really confirmed about the whole thing.
Do you have really good photographs of it?
Yeah, I do.
Can you get them to me?
I sent the wheel to you just about 10 minutes ago.
Okay.
That's under Coral Castle Answer.
Oh, all right.
Under your Mindspring.
ArtBellMindspring.com.
But I have many more pictures if you want them after that. You let me know.
Yeah, if you want to follow up, by all means, follow up, and I'll try and keep my mailbox jams up so quickly. I'll try and keep it open for you. So, yeah, if you want to send any others, that would be really nice.
I've been waiting a long time to tell you about this wheel, too.
It
was so exciting for me.
That may be part of a really ancient technology.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think what he did was, I think You know the tripod that he used that people think that he was using to move the stones?
Yes.
On top of those tripods, I think he had either a battery or something that he ran wires from that to the tower. He had like a stone tower, the highest point of his structure.
All right, listen, I have your email. I'm looking at your email right now.
Well, see, he just
hold on. Your attachment did not come through.
Ah.
So send it as Coral. Just call it coral.jpg or something like that. I don't know how you send it. It looks like windmail of some sort or something.
All right.
Can you do that?
Yeah, I'll send it again.
All right. That's probably why I didn't get it before, because it didn't come through as an attachment.
Well, what's really strange is the way he made this. It's like he totally constructed it from car parts. He took these batteries and mounted them in, like, I can't even describe. You'll know when you see the picture. But it's like his first experiments was turning it with a hand crank, and then he went to, like, compressed air. The structure of the tower had a built-in metal pipe that you could tell that was for compressed air that he disassembled before he died.
Fascinating.
It's really strange. Yeah, the whole thing is really strange. But I got a lot of good pictures, and I will try to get them to you. I sent my phone number, so I keep my phone number, and in case I can't get them through this time, I'll try to keep getting them through.
All right, and I can clearly see why it didn't. I'm going to try and rename
your
photograph.
When you see it, you're going to be really excited, because there's a lot more to it. Nobody's listened to me about this for a long time, and I finally get to tell you about it.
He had to know something. He had to,
right.
Obviously, had to be onto something, right?
There's a lot of strange things, and even in the museum, he actually had, there's a piece of rock that has been unidentified also. Nobody talks about that either. It's in the museum right now.
All right.
A piece of rock that he used for, you know, that big stone door that opens with a finger?
Right.
You can push it with a finger. It's
right.
Huge. That, he used that special rock that he found to make that bearing system in the bottom of that, because the first one wore out.
Oh, my God. I renamed your file, sir, and I've got the photograph.
Oh, great.
Oh, my God.
Thank God. I finally got it through to you.
I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to email this to Keith, my webmaster.
Count the magnets and count all the way around, and it matches half of exactly what that guy was doing in Canada. That's what was really amazing.
Uh-huh. Okay, let's see. I'm going to send this
to the same track as what that guy's doing.
Okay. I'm going to... have you ever seen these photographs?
I'm dying to build this thing, too.
Yeah, I understand. Have you seen the photographs that this man is talking about, Brad?
No.
You haven't?
I have. See, he also has a bunch of other experiments that he was working on, like homemade light bulbs.
Right.
And there wasn't a whole lot there, but very long, long wires that I noticed in the photograph ran to those tripods, and the tops of those tripods are boxed
in. To that big
in.
Tower, you say?
Yeah, the tower is his main, that's where he did all his stuff.
As I say, we just saw a documentary probably 2 weeks ago.
You go there right now. You can go there to Homestead. You can go there right now. I mean, you can go, and it's there right now. It's sitting right there. Nobody talks about it. I can't believe it. I've been dying to tell people about it.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. As we speak, it's winging its way toward my webmaster right now. I just did that as the two of you were chatting.
The basic idea of what I think he was doing was changing the polarity of an atom in a mass. When you do that, it changes all the atoms in that mass.
Well, yours is a very, very, very good specific photograph, sir. And I'm going to get it up, credit you on the website. You took it yourself, right?
Yeah, took all of it.
And you're giving us permission to put it on the website, right?
Sure.
All right, thank you very much. Keith, I know you're listening. Hope you're listening. I just sent the photograph to you. I had to send it separate from his email. Please get it up on the site ASAP. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Brad Steiger. Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Hi.
I'm just fascinated by what you're talking about, and I believe in, I have seen certain things since I was young, UFOs, what I call the black people, certain little things that were mysterious to me. But I'm with you as far as all of this, some sort of way being connected.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand or know how, but a lot of the principles that I believe that are into that Coral Castle thing you guys were talking about is some sort of reverse polarity or something, using the Earth's polarity to make things, magnetism to come against.
That could be.
With the small UFO I saw as a as an 18-year-old that made no sound and was so small that no one could be inside of it that I could figure, you know, 3 foot high.
Mm.
And but the ability to move from dead zero to a blinding, zigzaggy speed is just, to me, smacks of magnetism.
Where did you see this? Where were you?
I'm in Gainesville, Georgia here, and
okay.
This happened, and I live like out in a rural part out on a chicken farm.
Okay.
And was coming home one night and saw a small craft with a red light blinking in the middle of it and two white orbs, which looked like an airplane off in the distance.
Mm-hmm.
And as I went down a hill, the craft went down the hill also. So when I got to the top of the hill, I stopped the automobile, and the craft stopped. And in the moonlight, I could see this.
Did you feel it was observing you?
It was observing me.
Mm-hmm.
And all I could think of, I'm 44 now, so this happened like when I was 18, but the Merv Griffin guys were real popular, the ones down in Louisiana or somewhere, that several fishermen had got picked up or something like that, and so I was...
Oh, yeah, in Pascagoula, the two fishermen. That
right, were. Right, that one. So that was in the news at the time or whatever, and I really got scared and flew on down the road.
Yeah,
and
you,
to my
you didn't want to go through what they had gone through.
Slid into the driveway and telling them I seen a UFO up the street, and when I turned around, I said, and there it is right there. And it sit out over our pasture over a pine tree for 22 to a half a minute or so, and then just took off just like that, just boom.
All right, sir. Thank you very much.
Great story.
Welcome to the
thank
club.
You.
John in Toronto asked an interesting question going back to the Giants, and then I've really got something for you. He asks, have DNA screenings been done on any of the North American Giants? And if so, have comparisons been done with Giants of other parts of the world?
That's a very interesting question, and I can't give a complete answer to that. I think that some people are trying to do that now. There are bits of hair on some of these skeletal remains.
That would be plenty for DNA, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would. It would. And I hope that someone is doing that as we speak. But
right.
I certainly will follow through on that.
You know this man who we just talked to who took the picture at Coral Castle?
Yes.
Well, we live in an amazing electronic age. Even though I couldn't bring the picture up, I renamed it, brought it up, got it going, and sent it to Keith. And Keith has it on the website right now.
Already.
Under What's New, the first item is Magnetic Wheel at Coral Castle. It's the damnedest picture you've ever seen. Is Sherry still awake?
I'm not sure, but I will check it as soon as I can there.
Okay, please, we're not going to have another break, unfortunately.
Oh.
So you can't reach over to a computer, can you?
No, I can't.
Oh, too bad. For everybody else, this incredible magnetic wheel, this man took a hell of a picture of it, and we've got it on the website right now. Boy, technology's not all bad. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Brad Steiger. Hello.
Art?
Yes.
Mr. Steiger, I think back in the 60s you wrote a book called Flying Saucers Are Hostile.
Yes. That's way back.
Yes. A lot of some researchers still agree with that, like Bud Hopkins and Dr. David Jacobs.
That's right.
And I know you're an expert on Native Americans. What do you think about the reptile people? Because Art had somebody on Red Elk who believed in the reptile beings.
Well, that's been sort of the basis of I've written 22 books on UFOs now, and each one looks at the UFO mystery from a little different angle because I think that's how complex it is. And what Art and I did in the source was kind of try to tie a lot of things together. But the reptilian, I've said for years now that we could very well be dealing with an terrestrial or extraterrestrial reptilian species. They could have in their world or even in our planet, because we've had enough time on our planet for more than one evolution of a superior species. So I was really excited when I saw some of the research of two Canadian scientists who, and I've used this illustration, I had a drawing made of what a reptile or what a dinosaur man would look like. And it's, for all the world, Spinachosaurus, which had a flexible thumb, for all the world is what people are describing when they're having UFO encounters with what is euphemistically known as the Greys at this time.
Yes.
And I've felt this since the 60s when I participated in a number of hypnotic regressions of abductees and contactees.
You have revised your view of the relative danger of UFOs and those who inhabit them or pilot them or whatever?
Well, at that time, again, that was not the title I chose. It was simply indicating that one should be very cautious in approaching UFOs and cautious in dealing with the entire mystery because it could be hazardous to your health.
I'm not sure that's changed.
Well, I'm not either. But I guess what's changed is my attitude is that the entire phenomenon is hostile. I think here again, a lot of it is who you are is what you get. But I certainly, in this entire field of the paranormal art, I continually advise caution. This is not fun and games. This is not to be taken lightly. To me, this is serious business.
Oh, I certainly agree with that. Oh, my God, this photograph. When we get off the air, you've got to go see
it. Sherry's getting it for me.
Oh, she is?
Oh, she's just the greatest wife anyone could
have. All right, it's the first item under What's New on my website. And you've got to remember, when you look at this photograph, this man built this, and it's clearly a rotational magnetic assembly. So if you have a second, I'll even wait. If you can, if Sherry has it, you can.
She's just bringing it to me now, love.
Okay.
All right. Wow.
Now look at that. Look at that, Brad.
Hmm.
That the man who built the Coral Castle built what you're looking at there. It's clearly a magnetic, rotational, and God, it almost looks like there was a movie which I can't think of the title of right now, which had something that looked like almost looked like this, and was it some sort of a portal or time transport?
Was it Contact?
Not a Contact.
Sherry's saying it looks like the what's-its that we have in Rainbow Conspiracy.
This incredible,
huge artifact that was found on government land, and the picture was given to us, and as some kind of device that has little hieroglyphics all over it.
Yeah, well, you've just got to remember, this is inside a building that was impossible to build.
Right.
The man went to the grave, as you pointed out, with a secret after being beaten, but look at this thing. Good Lord.
Yeah.
It's the best picture I've ever seen. I've heard about Coral Castle, and I've seen pictures of the outside of it, but I've never seen anything like this. That's amazing.
It wasn't in the documentary we just saw.
Well, it probably should have been, huh?
It should have been.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Brad Steiger and Art Bell. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. And Mr. Steiger, how you doing? This is really an honor. You know, I've been listening to you for almost 10 years now. This is Michael in Phoenix.
Yes, Michael.
And you know, the main question that I have right now for both of you, if I could address both of you, is Art and Rod, what influence do you think that these extraterrestrials, these beings that are not of our space and time, what do you think that they're doing? You know, how much are they influencing our destiny and especially our evolution, our genetic evolution? Which might, you know, bring to mind the question, why do we have different races of human beings? And where are we going in evolution?
I mean, that's a lot to answer.
Yeah.
How are they influencing us? In a way, we answered that toward the beginning of the program, or just after the beginning of the program, in that we are more than just physical beings and connected to more, but that's a pretty non-specific.
The subtitles of one of my books, Gods of Aquarius, is UFOs and the Transformation of Man. So that kind of says our attitude. Sherry and I, again, have our research, and that's why it ended up so much in the Giants, We've gone to many, many foreign countries and been collecting artifacts, which we feel indicates that at least as a thesis, we feel that the influence on our evolution has been considerable and probably on our destiny is interwoven with our own. I think that there is an incredible advanced symbiotic relationship between us and the other.
They may have some interest, self-interest.
I think they need us as much as we need them. Only they know why, and we don't yet.
I don't suppose you make an appearance, even a cameo or whatever, in special, do you?
Well, yeah, I would say so.
Oh, you do? So, as interview style, or
yes.
Oh, well, that makes it even more interesting.
Yeah, Alex Hamilton Brown is the wonderful man who put this together. And Graham Whiffler, who has done a number of specials for NBC. And David McCallum is the narrator. He was a friend, a boyhood chum of Alex's dad back in Scotland. And this grew out of Alec Hamilton Brown reading my Worlds Before Our Own in the British edition and cherishing the idea, the chapter, Giant Men and Giant Reptiles.
So it's coming up this Friday. Check local listings on the Learning Channel. Bless their heart for doing this, and bless your heart for being here tonight, Brad.
We aren't over already.
We are. It's a superb program. Thank you, and thank you so much.
Thank you, my friend. I enjoyed it as always.
Good night.
Good night.
All right, listen, everybody. I have never in my life seen anything like this man sent me. This is amazing. You've got to see it. It's on my website right now at artbell.com. This is a machine that the man who made the Coral Castle constructed. It's clearly rotational and electromagnetic in nature, and I want all of you to take a look at this and comment to me in email or otherwise. Yes, sir, I want the rest of the photographs. Best ones I've ever seen, and I've never seen one of this. It's awesome. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. Good night. Now, Senator Harry Reid actually does come from a smaller town than I do, Searchlight, Nevada. From humble beginnings in the tiny town of Searchlight to the second highest ranking Democrat in the U.S. Senate, Harry Reid has distinguished himself as a fighter for Nevadans and all American families in the corridors of power in Washington, D.C., recognizing his trajectory in public service. The Las Vegas Sun said that Reid, quote, has gone from underdog to the Senate's top dog, end quote. Parade Magazine, the nation's largest weekly, identified Senator Reid as one of a handful of leaders in Washington who possesses, quote, integrity and guts, end quote. The Nevadans first elected him to the Senate in 1986, and he has developed a reputation as a consensus builder and a very, very accomplished legislator. He is my senator in Washington. And here's something, just a partial statement. I won't read it all because really he can tell you about it. But this was a statement by Senator Reid Friday, February 15th. Quote, today President Bush has betrayed our trust and endangered the American public by deciding to ship 77,000 tons of nuclear waste across the entire country and store it at Yucca Mountain, Nevada. As a candidate for president, George W. Bush declared, quote, I believe sound science, not politics, must prevail in Washington, must prevail in the designation of any high-level nuclear waste repository, and Washington as well. As president, I would not sign legislation that would send nuclear waste to any proposed site unless it's been deemed scientifically safe, end quote. He said this while campaigning in Nevada in May of 2000. You know, he was here in Nevada, said that. Didn't ask us to read his lips, but asked us to believe him. Nevadans did. George W. Bush would not be president without having received Nevada's votes in the Electoral College. You remember that debacle of an election that we had? Well, without Nevada, it would not have been President Bush, and Without that promise, I doubt that he would have had Nevada here. From, I'm not sure exactly where, maybe at home in Searchlight is Senator Harry Reid. Senator?
Yes, I am in Searchlight. I have a home there. Here, I should say, and that's where I am.
At home. All right. Well, as you well know, your little town is actually smaller than mine in Trump.
Yes, a lot smaller.
Senator, take it from there. I mean, I didn't read your entire statement, but I've got a million questions. I mean, how angry are you about what has happened here?
Well, I just feel that if we go back and look at the election, George Bush came to Nevada once. He came to Lake Tahoe. He wouldn't take questions from the press because at that time he was afraid to answer any questions regarding nuclear waste because his position had always been contrary to Nevada's interests. But as the election got closer and closer and he felt Nevada's four electoral votes may mean something, and at that time Gore was ahead in the election, he issued a number of statements through other people, through the Vice President Cheney, through Governor Gwynn and others, saying that he would not allow nuclear waste to come to Nevada except if there were good science. And
all right, well, that's the obvious next question. How is the science on this? What do you know?
Well, from the time that he made that statement till today, the science has been turned on its head. For example, the General Accounting Office, which is the watchdog of Congress, certainly no one can ever accuse them of being anything but unbiased. They said that it was not ready to have a recommendation made because as we speak, there's 292 scientific investigations that the DOE is waiting for. In addition to that, the Nuclear Waste Technical Review Board, which is an entity set up to review nuclear waste, again, independent. This one is led by former dean of the Yale School of Forestry. He's now president of Carnegie Mellon in Pennsylvania, one of the finest schools in America. He, through and his group, said the science at Yucca Mountain is poor. We know that there's a big law firm that was giving legal advice to the Department of Energy, and their own inspector general found there was a conflict of interest because that law firm was also representing the Nuclear Energy Institute at the same time it was giving advice to the Department of Energy.
Oh, great.
So President Bush simply should not have done this. We learned in Time magazine that came out today that we're trying to get rid of soft money, you know, corporate money.
Mm-hmm.
And so Time magazine has gone into a review as to what money President Bush took in soft money, and $25,000 we know that he took from the Nuclear Energy Institute, the same group of people that's trying to put nuclear waste in Nevada. So he had plenty of information not to do what he did, just withhold what he was doing until he had some evidence to show there was sound science. He didn't wait to do that. I think it was unfair. I think he misled the American, not only the people of Nevada, but the American people. This, I'll stop by just saying this. The number one issue in America today with every environmental group, now you, on any issue, you usually get some environmental groups that don't always agree one way or the other. But
right.
Here they all agree that transportation of nuclear waste cannot be done safely.
What are the options? What else could be done besides sending it out here to us?
Let me say two things. First of all, these nuclear utilities, which have spent in the last 3 years $30 million lobbying Congress, giving campaign contributions, flying people to Las Vegas to take them up to Yucca Mountain for 2 hours and put them up here for 3 or 4 days. What we have found is that they say, well, we have to have it in one spot, so bring it to Nevada. Well, that's so ridiculous. Of the approximately 110 generating facilities we have in America today, you're never going to get rid of the nuclear waste because they continue generating it. So to say there's only going to be one spot is simply illogical. What do you do with it? Leave it where it is. That's what they're doing in various places around America today. Calvert Hills outside Boston, they're putting it in what they call dry cast storage containers. The scientists say it would be safe there for 100 years. It's cheap. It would be easier to secure it there than trying to haul it. Each one of these containers would weigh 135 tons. It would take 100,000 truckloads, 20,000 trainloads. That's 120,000 targets of opportunity for terrorists. So leave it where it is. It would be safe. It would be secure. and you wouldn't have to worry about transporting it.
And that is a solution for at least the next 100 years. And, of course, we're always looking to technology to save our butts somehow. So maybe by then we'd figure something out. Is that the idea?
That's absolutely right. We've made progress. Remember, this act that they're trying to put the stuff in Nevada based upon is 20 years old. A lot of things have happened in that 20 years. The only thing that hasn't happened is the Department of Energy, the bureaucrats down in the bowels of the Department of Energy. There may be administrations change, but the bureaucrats don't. And they have been pell-mell toward fulfilling that 1982 act, which by now is antiquated.
All right, well, let's try this angle, Senator. You know, obviously a lot of people listening all over the country are saying to themselves, screw Nevada, just like the bill said. Maybe people should understand across the country with regard to this issue how it might be even more unsafe for them than it would be for Nevadans. In other words, the getting of it, the transportation of it, is the risky part, or at least as risky as getting it here, isn't it?
I think it's more risky.
More risky.
And I believe that, especially since September 11th, we've got to be very careful. We have a Congressman, Ed Markey, who's a longtime member of Congress today, spoke out saying the nuclear facilities, they don't even check when someone goes to work there if they're a terrorist. They let them work there for 30 days while they're running the test to find out if they're qualified to work there.
Aye, aye, aye.
And you know, they're trying to ship this. One of the proposals is to ship from some of the reactors in the northern part of New York, shipping them down the river, Hudson River. These things are just, they do not have a plan for transportation, so you're absolutely right on target. It would be so, so dangerous to ship it, and this is a problem that would affect 43 states. It'll go through 43 different states.
Holy mackerel. 43 states.
Yep. And there'll be about 75 million people within a stone's throw of this. This will travel by the schoolyards, people's businesses, and, of course, their homes.
How much additional facility is there for storage left to cover the next 100 years? Is it sufficient if it stayed where it was?
What they would do is take them out of the cooling ponds, as I said at Calvert Hills, what they're doing there, take them out of the cooling ponds, put them in dry cast storage containers, which is on-site storage. And certainly, we've already spent at Yucca Mountain $8 billion. And it's estimated that by the time that's finished, it would be upwards of $80 billion, some say $100 billion, whereas you can store them on site for an average of maybe $10 or $15 million per site. Think of how the savings of that to the American people and the safety factor involved. I mean, realistically, you're not going to be able to ship 135-ton casks all over America. People aren't going to allow that to happen. We have learned in years past, at any time the federal government starts talking about you're okay with things nuclear, you go back to the early part of the last century where they had these over-the-counter drugs that people use for arthritis and toothaches and stuff, that rotted out people's bones and killed some. Mm-hmm. We know that X-rays, they said that was safe. My father-in-law died as a 53 years old from leukemia as a result of having worked as an X-ray technician as a young man. We know the above-ground nuclear test here in Nevada were extremely dangerous, made lots of people sick, and killed people. So when the federal government comes to us and said, don't worry, everything is going to be just fine, we're going to haul this stuff, and nobody has to worry about a thing. We're dealing with the most poisonous substance known to man, plutonium, and you can't haul it safely, especially with terrorists waiting around every corner.
And how long will this stuff have to be safely stored?
10,000 years, the way they have it now.
10,000 years?
10,000 years. That's why leaving it where it is and letting the scientists work on it. I mean, we have a number of very interesting proposals. Senator Menchie, a Republican from the state of New Mexico, and I do work together on the Energy and Water Subcommittee and Appropriations. We appropriate $22 billion a year, every year. Some of that goes to a lot of research at the labs. New Mexico has two labs. California has one. There are a number of other ones. And we think there's some really interesting things that can be done. We had a great program at Clinch River in Tennessee during the 70s and early 80s that was knocked out because they were afraid plutonium would get in the hands of the Soviets. Had we stayed on that program, we wouldn't need any Nevada test site. Yucca Mountain.
Okay, where are we realistically, politically? Is it all over, or what are the options that are ahead of us, if any?
No, it's not all over. The recommendation, the president started a time running. The governor of Nevada now has till about the middle of April to veto this. He will do that probably in early April. It will come to Congress, then Congress has 90 days to act on it. Both houses of Congress have to override Governor Gwynn's veto. House of Representatives is a lost cause. That will happen automatically, but it's not going to happen automatically in the Senate. Senator Ensign and I, he's the other senator from Nevada. He's a Republican. I'm a Democrat. We're going to work to try to get some more votes.
When you count now, how does it come out?
Well, President Clinton, when he vetoed the last time they tried to do this under a different statutory framework, we were able to get 33 Democrats and 2 Republicans. With Senator Ensign there now, who is a Republican, we're hopeful that we're going to get more. I'm working hard on the Democrats. He's working hard on the Republicans. And our goal is to get 51. That's what we need. We're not there yet. We're probably in the 37 or 38, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a lot of things to do. We hope to be able to change people's minds. The 2 senators from Utah certainly should try to help us because they know what it's like to have nuclear waste jammed down their throat. They tried to do it in Indian Reservation there. We have great expectations for the 2 senators from Vermont who hadn't voted with us before, and that's an extremely environmentally conscious state. We hope that there are 2 Democrats there, or I should say a Democrat and an independent. In New Hampshire, we have hopes there. That's turned into an extremely environmentally conscious state. So anyway, we're working on all kinds of things to get the numbers up to 51.
I've got to ask this question, and it is, if it becomes at some point absolutely inevitable, irreversible, irrevocable, it's coming here, we've lost. There are many people out there who would ask, well, some stupid person once said, if it's to be raped, then finally relax and enjoy it. Should Nevada reap benefits monetarily will Nevada reap benefits monetarily if it happens?
Once you start discussing price, you become a prostitute, no matter what
the
price may be. And the fact is, people who say, well, what we'll do is we won't have to pay income tax. These people are living in a dreamland. Just like New Mexico, which has low-level waste at the facility there called the WIP Facility Waste Isolation Project.
Yes.
They were promised all kinds of things. They've gotten nothing. And you know, there's nothing to give. I mean, last year we had a surplus of over $4 trillion. We now have a deficit of zero, zip, nothing. Well, where's the money going to come from? Nevada's going to get nothing for this, and that's why we shouldn't get nuclear waste.
So you don't even entertain that discussion. If all finally became lost, would you at that point work for Nevada to receive something for what it's going to be put through?
I'm a realist, and my realism tells me there is nothing there. There's nothing to give us. Well, why in the world would give it to us? I mean, the president already has told us how he feels about Nevada. You know, he's got problems with education and all kinds of things. He's not going to give any money for Nevada. And, you know, we get I mean, it just is a question without an answer that makes any sense. The answer is,
there's no money.
No, there's no money to give us. And where's it going to come from? Are we going to take it from education? Are we going to take it from transportation? Are we going to take it from Pennsylvania? They'd be happy to give us their money. I mean, it's just, it won't work. So the answer is, people who think we're going to get monetary gain from this are foolish. If that repository ever came into being, it would create less than 200 permanent jobs. Well, that many people quit a job every day at the MGM.
That's right. Maybe you would like to comment on some recent news, and this is sort of unrelated. Maybe it's related to the way you do what you do. Responding to federal judges' orders, this is a lead story this hour. The Bush administration turned over thousands of documents today related to Vice President Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force. And now most of the papers were blanked out. Now, I wonder if trouble in this area, in some loose way, with regard to behavior, relates to what's going on with the whole dump site.
Of course it does, and that is why that I've joined in the litigation that has been filed against the vice president. shouldn't we as the American people know who he met with to come up with an energy policy for this country?
You bet.
I don't think that's asking too much. We're asking who he met with, when he met with him, and where they met. We're not asking even to divulge all the information, although I think that's going to come out someday. And, you know, people said, well, aren't other presidents that you've worked with, haven't they tried to keep things secret? The answer is absolutely yes. I've worked with a lot of them. But once, I understand why they try to keep things close to their chest. But once they've been discovered, they just give the stuff up. But not here. There's something more than meets the eye here. I do not understand this.
Senator, we all know what politics is, and, you know, you get down to Nevada's votes, and they became, as you pointed out, really important. So they came here, and they told a lie. Have you ever been put in a position yourself, in a fight for re-election, where it came down to something like that? I mean, just having to tell somebody a bold-faced lie to get the last few votes.
Yeah, you can't do that. Now, there are times when you don't, when a person doesn't ask the right question, you know, you don't volunteer things that may not be in your interest, but you never lie. You never hide the truth. You know, I think that people, Ronald Reagan, as an example, there are a lot of things I disagreed with him politically, but I always felt that he was a person who told it the way it was.
He did.
And I admired him for that. So I don't think a person has to lie to be a successful politician. I mean, I can look at over my career, the people I've served with. Some people who are listening to this program, which covers so much area, will not remember him, but Governor Michael Callahan, who was governor of Nevada for 8 years, probably the best governor Nevada's ever had. And he's a person who would die before he would tell a lie. He's one of the most honest people I've ever known. George Mitchell, who was majority leader of the Senate.
Oh, yes.
I've served with some people who set a great example, who are certainly in keeping with what I think a member of the clergy should be, is for truth and veracity. So,
Senator, I know that we're right up against a half-hour break here. Are you able to stay for the next segment?
I'll be happy to.
Good. Good. Senator Harry Reid, our senator, my senator here in Nevada. And we're talking about all sorts of things, I guess ethics and government. Maybe we'll even talk a little bit about soft money and whether that signature really, really will go on the bill and whether it'll be a smile or a frown as he signs. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Once again, U.S. Senator Harry Reid. Senator Reid, again, with reference to where I live, I'm out here in Prum, Nevada, very close to where all this is going to be, and we had this big earthquake not all that long ago, about 7.3 out in the desert. And they're always saying that this is going to be very geologically safe. And they're constantly, we're having a lot of earthquakes on the California-Nevada border. It just doesn't seem that geologically safe. And then one other thing, Pahrump, Nevada, my little town, is growing so fast because it has this wonderful aquifer under it with all this water. And so we worry about that aquifer, and we worry about earthquakes and possibility of any of that stuff getting into the groundwater.
Well, first of all, I have a brother who lives on the Mariposa Valley, and he's concerned because he's closer than you are.
Right.
We know that from the work that's been done at the Nevada test site that there is a movement of water. We know that from some of the work that's been done up there, which has been a lot of the work. So we are concerned about that, and we have to be. I don't know if it takes a great deal of understanding. They say you don't have to be a rocket scientist to know that if you have the most poisonous substance known to man, put it in the ground and something happens. You talk about earthquakes. Yes, we have had earthquakes. In fact, if we could view now earthquake zones in the United States, there's only one other place in the whole United States that has more earthquakes than we do here where the test site is, the Yucca Mountain is. They're very close together. We've had 11 during the last 3 years, 11 earthquakes right at the Yucca Mountain. I think this is kind of a, well, and let me just say one other thing, Art. Originally, you were going to have three different sites the president would look at. They would characterize three sites, different rock formations. 1987, they decided to get rid of Texas and Washington and just stick with Nevada. Mm-hmm. But the scientists have determined, the DOE scientists have determined, that it cannot be geologically placed in Yucca Mountain. So what they're going to do, 90% of the Yucca Mountain will be a something to hold the nuclear waste. Well, I'm saying it won't be in the ground because the ground's not safe. So most people say, well, if that's the case, why do you need to do it there? You build it in the middle of New York City if you're going to just put it in a case and store it away. Mm-hmm. So they've got all kinds of problems, but they're sticking their head in the sand like the ostrich and saying these problems don't exist. But the American people are not going to let this stuff travel through 43 different states.
It might have been a year ago on Good Morning America, they had this incredible demonstration. A man took some really awful nuclear waste, put it through process while they were actually on the air on Good Morning America, and within 30 minutes had cut the amount of radiation coming from it by half. You wonder what happens to things like this. I mean, that was pretty high profile on Good Morning America. Do you know anything about that?
You mean to reduce the impact of radiation?
To actually reduce, yes, radiation in this material.
There are really some interesting things going on, and that's why I mentioned Domenici and I are going to spend some of our taxpayers' monies during the next couple of years to find out about them. They're all there as a result of the Star Wars program. There's been a lot of work done by scientists dealing with accelerators, and they believe that there's no question in my mind that the scientists are right who say that we no longer have to worry about nuclear waste the way we did in the past, because through the accelerators that have already been developed, you can knock out a lot of the bad things in nuclear waste within a matter of days, not 10,000 years. And so that we're going to work on that. Transmutation is one of the things it's called.
Yes.
There are a number of other programs. There's something that a number of Russian scientists have developed. I met with them and my science advisor last week in Washington. There is a product called thorium. There's thorium every place. It's almost as available as sand on the beach. And they believe through using thorium, you can also get rid of a lot of the bad things in nuclear waste.
What about power in America, Senator? Nuclear power plants, which already were sort of on the line of being financially viable, they really weren't all that financially viable, now face an additional expense because they're going to have to be guarded. The security of nuclear plants is going to have to go way up because they're obvious targets. So doesn't that make nuclear plants, new ones, for example, all the less viable?
I don't think America's going to build any new nuclear plants, that we haven't built one in almost 25 years, and there are none on the drawing boards. The reason for that is Three Mile Island and a number of other problems, not the least of which is the nuclear waste. But the problem with security existed before September 11th. We now are focusing on it as we should. As I indicated earlier in your program, Ed Markey, longtime congressman from Massachusetts, is very, very concerned about what the nuclear power plants are doing when they hire people. They hire somebody and then run the background check, which takes 30 to 45 days. During that 30 to 45 days, someone could get a complete layout of the plant. They could be a terrorist while they're there and do some bad things. I have joined with Joe Lieberman and Hillary Clinton, and I think I shouldn't mention their person name because I may be wrong, but we have a Republican working with us. I don't know who it is, and I don't want to embarrass the person.
All right.
But the four of us have called for doing something about the security force that guards all these plants. There should be standardized rules. We might want to, if we believe that it's important that there be federal rules and regulations for the employees that check your baggage, shouldn't there also be federal rules and regulations for people that are watching over nuclear power plants?
Absolutely. I had a report from one of our science reporters that one truck driver was able to just drive right onto the property of a nuclear plant while there was nobody at the guard shack. I mean, incredible, but true.
Yeah, and for someone to say, we've never had a nuclear accident, that's poppycock. We've just all we know is just a matter of 4 months ago on the Utah-Nevada border at Wendover. They said, what is this leaking out of this truck? And the truck driver said, well, I'm hauling low-level nuclear waste, so that's all it can be. So we've had that experience. We had also a few months ago the tunnel outside of Baltimore that caught fire. As you know, that tunnel was locked up for 1 week, almost shut down the city of Baltimore. There could have been a nuclear waste train in there. Luckily, there wasn't. But we cannot haul this stuff. I repeat, 100,000 truckloads plus 20,000 trainloads. It can't happen safely.
Well, it's all about power. We need power, and that's why they built the nuclear plants. Now,
and I didn't answer your question. I should do a better job of that. First of all, America cannot produce its way out of the problems we have. Out of the 100% of petroleum reserves in the world, the United States, including that that's anticipated in Alaska, we have 3% of the 100%.
Wow.
We, America, can't produce our way out of it. But what we can do is conserve our way out of it. We can really do a much better job of producing on the 3% that we do have. There's many things we can do. We have an energy bill that's on the Senate floor. When we get back, we worked on it already 13 days. We can do some things there. We need to make sure that we increase the fuel efficiency of vehicles. We need to make sure that we develop. Nevada is the Saudi Arabia of geothermal.
We have
so much potential here. North Dakota and Nevada are the geothermal of wind. And right now we produce less than 3% of the energy in America today with renewable products. It's not only is it just as good for producing electricity, but it saves our environment. That's where we have to go.
How do we get there? How do we go there? You're right about Nevada sun and wind. I've got wind generators here and solar panels here, and I power my house that way, Senator, but it's very expensive.
Art, first of all, wind now has a tax credit, and it can compete with anything. We're doing great things. And all through the farms in the Midwest, they're putting windmills on there. Farms, the reason they're doing it, they're able to sell that power.
Mm-hmm.
So we're doing a good job. Wind is competitive because we in Congress have given them a tax credit, and they now can compete with natural gas and coal. Where we have not given them financial incentives is solar and geothermal. They're doing it on their own, so to speak. We need to also incentivize that because the cost of electricity is more than the actual cost at the power plant. It's what it does with people's health. And what it does to the environment generally. And that we have to get to having not less than 3% of our energy produced by renewables, but we've got to get it up to... Senator Jeffords and I joined in legislation during the energy debate that we said by the year 2020, you would have to have 20%. I'm sorry, 2015, you'd have to have 20% of your energy produced with alternative. But we lost that. We only got 39 votes on that. That's too bad. But we are... we did defeat an effort last Thursday to eliminate all alternative energy. So in our new bill, we'll have 10% by that same time rather than 20%.
Well, I hope we can get there because it is a race. And if we lose it, some awful things are going to happen to our economy.
Well, not only to our economy, but I think also, I don't think it's just an accident that almost, I shouldn't say all children, that's an exaggeration, but many, many children in America today have respiratory problems. Asthma is so bad now in America, and it's because of the air. What other reason would it be?
Well, on many days, you live near it, you know, you can drive toward Henderson or Las Vegas, and it's like many other American cities, maybe a little worse, and it's just you don't recognize the fact that there should be a blue sky up there.
Or when I come back to Nevada, you know, I commute from Searchlight to Vegas and then, of course, fly to Reno.
Mm-hmm.
And I did want to say, and I'm not promoting any of your products, but I'm going to make a call tomorrow to this radio. I need a good radio out here because, you know, we depend a lot on radio and Searchlight. So
yes.
I'm glad to listen to it for no other reason than to get that number for the radio.
There you go. Well, all right. I guess everybody, what can we do? I guess the next question is, what can everybody do across the country that's worried about what's happening? What can we do?
Art, I'm so glad you asked that question. What people can do, as I said, the House of Representatives, we can't. The lobbyists, they take, as far as this issue, they control that. But In the Senate, it's not the case. And people within the sound of our voices, if they would contact the senators in their states and simply with a letter, a phone call to their office, say, do not allow nuclear waste to be transported across my state, whether they're calling from Wyoming, whether they're calling from Colorado, Arizona, wherever it might be, we need help. We need help with senators, and we're very, very close to winning this issue. This would truly be a victory for the American people because we are underdogs. We are being outspent. The state of Nevada finally appropriated some money to allow us to try to respond a little bit, and the businessmen in Nevada also came up with some money so we could hire some lobbyists to help us. You know, I am sorry to report that we had a difficult time finding somebody because the nuclear power industry literally had hired everybody at very, very large sums of money.
Wow.
We were fortunate to finally get President Reagan's former chief of staff, Ken Duberstein, and President Clinton's chief of staff, former chief of staff, John Podesta. So we were able to get those. But yet we had to go through a lot of people before we could get these people to help us.
That's remarkable. I mean, that's absolutely remarkable that they could have that much tied up. $30 million
in a little over $30 million in 3 years.
That's unimaginable power. That's some fight to have, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And so this is a very good message from the Art Bell Show because you know you're always touting the underdog, and here is an opportunity for people who are listening to this program tomorrow, or with the weekday, to contact their senators, wherever they might be.
What is the best way these days to contact your senator? Is it sending an actual letter? Is it email? I know letters are a hard thing in Washington now.
Letters, because the anthrax has really cut down their profitability. They don't work as well as they did, but you can still send a letter. The best way to do it is to call a senator's office and say, would you please deliver this message to Senator Smith of Oregon or Senator Hatch of Utah or Senator Allard of Colorado. Tell them that we do not want them to vote to allow nuclear waste to be transported across this country.
Senator, I've always wondered about that, and so has my audience. How does that work? When you make a call like that, do you, for example, in the morning get a report on
what? I get one every week.
Every week?
Yep. I get a report on my mail and my phone calls. And so it's very important. You know, sometimes...
What kind of influence is that on you?
I think what else can we depend on? You know, we're elected to use our best judgment on what we should do. But if people bring to our attention, for example, if when Chris gives me the mail report every week and I look at it and I say, man, look at the people calling in on nuclear waste. I better take a close look at that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it does help. And not only that, if there are enough calls coming in, I'll get a message before the week's out, people saying, you know, there's something that has to be done about this.
One last question, switching topics a little bit, the soft money thing. It's going to go to the president. The president is going to sign it. Would you say, with some hope in the back of his mind, that it's going to be overturned at the U.S. Supreme Court?
I think that there are a lot of people who, with reluctance, supported this, voted for it, and certainly the president has said that he doesn't like the bill very much, but he's going to sign it, are hoping that the courts will knock it out. I hope they get a real surprise there. In the early part of last century, Congress passed a law that said you could not use corporate money in federal elections. And that went on until about 12 years ago when the Nevada United States Supreme Court said that, well, you can't use money in federal elections, but you can give the money to state parties and they can do with that money whatever they want. So take, for example, the state of Nevada. In 1998, there was less than 2 million people in the state of Nevada. John Ensign spent $10 million. Harry Reid spent $10 million. And there was about $3 million in independent expenditures.
Really?
I think that's a little heavy. I think that's a little too much money. I think that those kinds of large money that come from those corporations are corrupting. I think that that doesn't mean everyone is corrupted, but it's corrupting. When people give these huge sums of money, $250,000, $100,000, $50,000, it is corrupting. And I think that the federal courts and the Supreme Court, I hope that they recognize that. I think that does free speech mean that the more money you have, the freer your speech is? I don't think that's the way our country was set up.
No, but that is sometimes the way it seems like it works.
And so I, I would hope that this will go to the... We did do a number of things I thought were pretty good in this legislation we drafted. We said that if one part's knocked out, it's not all knocked out. So if they declare one part of unconstitutional, one small part of it or one big part of it, that doesn't mean it's all unconstitutional.
Ah, so in other words, it couldn't be struck down across the board.
No, we set it up so that unless they struck it all down, and I'm almost positive they won't do that.
So I guess we'll all cross our fingers because that's how the power we were just talking about manifests itself, right?
Yeah, we need to get back the way when I first started running for federal office in our country, where you went to an individual and said, "Will you help me?" And they either said yes or no. And they were limited what they could give. Their names were published as to what money they gave, what their occupation is. And then pretty soon this corporate money stepped in, and there were all these faceless, nameless people who gave large sums of money to the state Democratic or Republican Party, and that's where all these vicious issue advocacy, that's where they came from. And that's what the people hate.
Senator, we're out of time. Thank you 10 million times for coming on, and I hope you get millions of responses to senators on the issue of the transportation of this stuff, because that's where the real danger is.
Thank you very much, Art. I don't get to say this to the rest of the people very often, but we're proud of you in Nevada. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Take care. That's Senator Harry Reid, my senator here in Nevada. And really, in a lot of ways, you're a senator, too, because as I said at the bottom of the hour, and you think about this, if they can knock down the two biggest buildings in New York City, imagine what they can do to trucks that have potentially much more killing power, transporting this crap all over the United States. You give that a little thought. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. Coming up next, Brad Steiger.